we could come to order. At this time, I will reconvene the Conservation Committee. Regarding committee item number 7, land donation, Palo Pinto County, no further action was required. Also, on committee item number 8, selection of the new internal auditor, I will authorize staff to place this item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. This committee has completed its business, and we will now move on to regulations, and I will hand the gavel to Chairman Friedman.
All right. Thank you, Mark. First order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have already been distributed.
Second.
Moved by Commissioner Duggins and second by Bivens. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Committee item number 1, land and water plan update. Mr. Smith.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman. Just consistent with the other discussions we've had, I want to formally acknowledge that Scott Borup is going to serve as our official staff liaison to the Regulations Committee, and again, just in an effort to help coordinate communication on agendas and how we vet regulations in the future, just want to formalize that. So looking forward to working with you in that regard. A couple things I want to highlight. One, I think as everybody knows, a huge area of emphasis for the department is our work with private landowners around the state. And our wildlife division really makes that one of their highest priorities and does a superb job on providing technical assistance to cooperating landowners. I think now we have close to 6,000 management plans around the state that encompass a little over 21.5 million acres. We had a big spike in the number and the amount of acreage enrolled in plans, largely with the new managed lands mule deer permit out in West Texas. That's been very, very popular. I think we've had another 4 million acres added to the program, so great success there. I saw Nathan Garner earlier, our East Texas regional director, and they have been working, as you all know, for many years on trying to recover the eastern turkey in East Texas, and we just had another release in partnership with a number of private landowners. I think we released about 100 birds out in East Texas. The Cooks Branch Conservancy is a real primary partner with us on that, and so we're pleased about those efforts. On the coast, every February, we work with local communities, law enforcement, coastal fisheries, volunteers, fishing guides to help pick up all of those abandoned crab traps. As you all know, those are a real sink for catching a lot of species. They'll get left out in the bays, and so that's a real problem. So that's been going on for about the last 7 years. A lot of pickup that went on in Galveston Bay and San Antonio Bays, but a very, very successful program and a lot of participation throughout the coast from a variety of constituent groups. I'm very pleased to share that in May, our 53rd class of the Texas Game Warden Academy will graduate, and that's significant for a number of reasons. One, it will be the last graduating class that will go through the academy at our current location on 51st Street in Austin. We are in the throes of selling that site and moving our training facility to Hamilton County. I've had a chance, as have many others, to meet with this class of cadets. It is a remarkable group of young men and women. We're very, very proud of them and looking forward to them joining our team in May formally. We also have applications out right now to solicit applications for our 54th class of Texas Game Wardens, and they will be the inaugural class to go through the academy at our new site in Hamilton County. And so we're really excited about that new facility. For those of you who have not yet had a chance to go up and see that site, I would strongly encourage you to do so. I think once it is fully built out, it's just going to provide a world-class training opportunity for our law enforcement team. And we're excited about everything that, that our training team is doing with them. So with that, I think I'll turn it back to you. So thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Okay, in order to accommodate some schedules, we're going to move to committee item number 9, Homeland and Border Security, and then go back to number 2. Colonel Flores.
Any chair you want, Sheriff.
Mr. Smith, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, my name is Colonel Peter Flores, Director of Law Enforcement.
It's my pleasure this afternoon to present Sheriff Siggy Gonzalez, one of our partners in law enforcement in Texas. He's a sheriff of Zapata County, and he's here to join me to get today in a discussion about border issues and homeland security. You know, homeland and border security issues is a real issue for law enforcement in Texas, and the Texas Homeland Strategic Plan for 2005 to 2010 requires close coordination among state, local, and federal authorities in an effort to build capabilities to prevent, protect against, respond to, and recover from all threats to the homeland. Our Texas game wardens have historically had a close relationship with local law enforcement entities, and operations in Zapata are pretty much showcase that. I think we're going to give you examples today of the close duty roles that game wardens play in our role in local and state and national security. Texas game wardens' duties in conservation law enforcement place us in a unique and important role in the security of citizens of both Texas and of our country. On September the 11th, our world changed, and it changed for all of us as people, as a nation, as a people, but especially for those of us who take a solemn oath to protect and serve. So we secure the nation's borders with the requirement for state and local governments to increase the security of U.S. citizens and their property within the border areas. The Law Enforcement Division's mission is Texas game wardens are responsible for the enforcement of Parks and Wildlife Code, all TPD regulations, and the Texas Penal Code, selected statutes and regulations that are applicable to the clean air, water, hazardous materials, and human health. As it relates to TPWD mission and homeland security, our Texas game wardens accomplished the TPWD law enforcement mission as conservation as well as homeland security, mainly because of the role that we play off the pavement in the Texas law enforcement apparatus, and especially at the state level. It's just we are the ones that are out off the pavement in the ranch land, in our waterways, and out in the Gulf of Mexico. The Law Enforcement Division provides safe boating and recreational water safety on public waters by ensuring compliance of applicable state laws and regulations. So as it pertains to the totality of the mission, whether it be dams, our power plants, ports along the seacoast, or the Rio Grande, Amistad, or Falcon, it's your Texas game wardens are out there doing the conservation mission, but at the same time maintaining our oath as peace officers. We have in homeland security, we have a commitment of resources to demonstrate our presence and thereby deter illegal activities along the Texas-Mexican border. The Texas-Mexican border is 1,254 miles in length, accounts for over two-thirds of the entire U.S. border with Mexico. Borders with northern Mexican states, terrain variants includes deserts, mountains, brushy plains, pasture lands, coastal plains, and of course out 9 nautical miles to the Gulf of Mexico. This is an example of the role that our wardens do. This is I put this slide on here to demonstrate a case in West Texas. This is Game Warden Ray Spears. Those of you who met him in Brewster County, he just transferred back home to El Paso County. But Ray was out one night working for knife hunters outside of Alpine. Watched the spotlight coming across the pasture, and it was pretty bumpy that night, pretty early morning hours. Went to intercept them, and the chase was on. Went through a number of fences, went out on the highway outside of Alpine. And if you notice, there's, in this particular case, you might not see it there, but there's one shotgun shell there. There was one shot, one load of dope. And he stopped the vehicle. It wasn't a road hunter, or a night hunter. It was a doper. And that's what they run out, and our game wardens run across routinely in the course of their duties as conservation officers. Another one of our missions in homeland and border security and international waters is to reduce violent border crime and thereby protect its citizens. Texas is pursuing a strategy that calls for stronger law enforcement and presence throughout the Texas border area. The Law Enforcement Division provides a comprehensive statewide law enforcement program to protect Texas wildlife and other natural resources and environment. To reinforce our message, that those are Mexican netters on Falcon Reservoir, where netting is okay on the Mexican side, but not on our side, and it's a problem we've been dealing with since the institution of the lake. But so we're out there anyway, we're doing conservation work, but we run across a number of other things. Of course, primarily we're out there to catch them in the resource protection of our fisheries, Those are an example of some of the gill nets and hoop nets we get from the Mexican fishermen. Some of our challenges along these bordering waters and bordering areas, is in the case of Zapata and Falcon Lake, is a Mexican commercial fisherman illegally fishing Texas. So they're going to come after the resource because we've got them. We've got the resource on our side, so they're going to go after it. There's a market nearby in Monterrey and other areas. But we've working together with the sheriff, our wardens out there have done a good job of apprehending these folks. Another one of our challenges is the Mexican commercial fishermen are also involved in smuggling drugs and humans. I guess they're efficient in their criminal enterprises. And not only are while they may drop a net, at the same time they may drop a load of dope or take a load of aliens, all in one trip. And commissioners that have had the opportunity, Commissioner Cohen and Martin, have accompanied us on the border and been able to see the challenges that are involved in operations along the border. Those of you that have ranches along the border understand how easy it is just to, that old saying, if I can only make it to the Mexican border, it'll be all right. Well, we try our best not to let them get across the line when they cross ours. Mainly we want to deter them from coming in the first place. Fishermen who are incarcerated, a lot of times they choose to serve their time out in jail instead of paying fines. Of course, we seize their equipment, we get their boats, we get their motors, that's forfeit. But the jail time is not a deterrent, it's primarily a fiscal deterrent at that point. Zapata County, for example, doesn't have the financial resources to house these type of prisoners all the time, although the federal system is starting to improve with the Border Patrol, is improving in the manner in which they handle these repeat aliens. But generally, the financial resources of the counties, especially the border counties, it strains them. Mexican commercial fishermen pretty much have total disregard for, U.S. law, Texas Water Safety Act, anything like that. It really doesn't matter. It's just they're in a commercial enterprise. Here's an example of a load on Falcon Reservoir that our game wardens intercepted and arrested. Well, this is the typical Mexican fishing vessel that you'll find down in the Brownsville area or in Falcon or Amistad. But in this case, with contraband seizures that our game wardens routinely run across are gill nets, hoop nets, drugs, and boats and motors. In this particular case, our game wardens intercepted these individuals with a boatload of dope. And you can see, as I pointed out earlier, at the course of our conservation work, where you see in the front, in the enterprise, you look at the front of the boat has gill net and the back of the boat has dope. They're just very efficient at their criminal enterprise. And there's been times we've run across loads of liquor, and you just never know what you run into. But at the same time, they're also plundering our resources. And the other load is a load of dope that is pretty much our wardens and working with Zapata County intercepted that was unloaded on the bank. I understand that Steve McGraw is present. Steve is here. Steve is from the governor's office. He's the state director of Homeland Security. We welcome you. Thank you for being here. I included this slide because this is pretty recent. This is at the very end of the hunting season, and this was in Jim Hawk County and Webb County line. Our wardens were working a ranch near Morando City, working deer hunters. Come across this truck. Truck started to take off, giving a good probable cause. Something was wrong, amiss, and sure enough, it wasn't deer they were hiding from us, but a load of marijuana. Homeland Security and the International Water Patrol on Lake Amistad, where our game wardens are engaged on, because of our role off the pavement and our primary role, we've been referred to by Governor Perry and by President Bush as Texas Navy, and that's because of our unique role as state law enforcement on the public waters. Also on the coast, I'd be remiss to mention the coast, the Captain Williams is one of our 65-footers that patrols the Texas coastal waters. As part of our coastal patrol, we had the Captain Williams also and other vessels like it. In this particular case, we're removing illegal nets, Mexican nets out in the Gulf of Mexico. In this particular case, dolphins were entangled in this net, if you all remember that particular incident. Patrolling at night along the vast stretches of the lower coastal plain and the intercoastal waterway. This particular slide showcases of our wardens patrolling the intercoastal. Did a water safety inspection of a vessel that was supposed to be a sportsman and ended up with a load of DOPA board. Things didn't look right. Their training kicked in, and their role as conservation officers have evolved in time to be a first-line defense because of where we operate against criminal organizations. And this line of defense, of course, includes interdiction, drugs, human trafficking, and smuggling. Because of these efforts, we were fortunate enough by the grace of the legislature and help from Governor Perry, general revenue was appropriated to the division for its law enforcement operations for the first time. And with general revenue appropriated for 2008, it's $2,250,793 and $1,854,400 for a total of $4,001,000 in general revenue, which is very important to note that the general revenue as opposed to coming from Fund 9. It is an important part because of the role that we do in our peace officer capacities while doing conservation work. And more importantly, it also added 15 more game wardens for assignment along the Mexican border and in our ports. And just for clarification, this doesn't mean that they're there to do border patrol work or catch aliens. They're there to be a force multiplier, more boots on the ground, doing work, our conservation work, off the pavement, but by being Texas peace officers and providing that extra line of defense, which ultimately will serve to protect us all from criminal elements that would prey upon our resources, but most importantly, off our public safety. At this point, I'd like to pass the program over to the Sheriff, Sheriff Gonzalez's presentation, and this will not be on your laptops because of its format, but you'll have it, Sheriff. And again, if you guys need to click for you, or click on the right there, okay. That right button. And is logo come up now? If you press the right.
Cardinal Flores, could I ask you to introduce our honored guest?
This is Sheriff Steve Gonzalez, the Sheriff of Zapata County, a long-term friend and partner, and also a president of the Border Sheriffs Coalition, one of the founding members. Very involved. He's been to Washington, D.C. He's been all over the country speaking on behalf of Texas's issues. And he would like to take the time today to brief the commission about the role of law enforcement as it pertains to our border. Sheriff?
Thank you, Colonel, and thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Smith, thank you for
commissioners.
Coming.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. Of course, we're always interested in working with every agency, every state agency, local agency, federal agency we possibly can. The ultimate goal, of course, is protecting the citizens of this great state of ours, this great nation of ours. And with that, I will start by telling you that, my name's up there, I am the president and vice chairman of the Southwestern Border Sheriffs Coalition. I take over as chairman in May. I was the founding member, you could say, or the one in to blame, I guess, for the sheriffs getting together along the border and expressing our concerns and our problems really that we have along the border, our mutual problems. We started the Texas Border Sheriffs Coalition in May 2005, and we did that out of frustration from the federal government's inadequacy in protecting our border. And I'm not talking immigration-wise, I'm talking criminal-wise. We were seeing many, many criminals coming into this country, and we still are. A lot of rapists, a lot of murderers, a lot of people that have ill intent in things that they want to do to this country of ours. I started calling sheriffs on the border, and we said, we need to, do you think you have the same problems in your counties? And they said, yes, we do. So we called for a meeting in Laredo, Texas, May 2005, and we formed the Texas Border Sheriffs Coalition. Through our coalition, we came up with a plan, and it's just like a football team. Different positions in a football team. We have your linebackers, your safety, your safeties, your defensive line, and things like that. We called our operation. We wanted to do this Operation Linebacker. Basically, it's a second line of defense, assisting Customs and Border Protection, the protection of this country. Border Patrol being the first line of defense, we've been the linebackers. Whatever would come past Border Patrol, other than immigration cases, then we were there to hopefully be able to stop them from coming into the country. So our operation, again, is intended really to identify, apprehend, and prevent terrorists and their weapons of mass destruction from entering this country of ours. We, again, have seen many criminals come into the country, and I'll mention some of them in a little bit, but that is one of our missions in Operation Linebacker. Another mission of ours is to identify, apprehend, and prevent criminals and aliens from special interest countries from entering our country. I'll talk a little bit about Edgar Aníbal Rivera Paz, who is responsible for a bombing in Honduras in which many people died. He has come into this country at least 4 times and he's been apprehended, and he's still coming back again. So we want to stop those people from coming into this country. We also, as part of our operation, also wanted to seize and deter any type of contraband from entering the United States. By contraband, we mean narcotics, humans from special interest countries that have an interest in ill will against us in this country. And also, of course, to protect the United States and its citizens by stopping with additional patrol, harmful materials, contraband, and individuals with no legitimate right from entering the United States. What I did when we started this coalition is I went ahead and took the formal definition, I guess you could say, of domestic terrorism. So the best definition I could find was the FBI's definition, since they are supposedly the ones in charge of protecting our country against a terrorist attack. And their definition is very simple. Unlawful use of force or violence committed by a group of 2 or more individuals against persons or property to intimidate or coerce a government, the civilian population, or any segment thereof in furtherance of political or social objectives. For the exception of those last 4 or 7 words there, in furtherance of political or social objectives, what's happening on the border is, in fact, domestic terrorism. Many of our citizens are afraid that they're going to get kidnapped and taken back to Mexico never to be seen again. Many of our citizens, as I'm sure Dr. Falcón can attest, are coming into their cars from a mall and being carjacked, taken to Mexico, and then leaving bodies on the side of the road, leaving people there for dead just because they want to take that car. People, in fact, are living in fear. People don't want to farm their land anymore because they're afraid that they're going to get robbed. Some people are afraid of opening or closing the gate to the ranch when they're going in or out of the ranches because they're afraid also of getting assaulted. Not necessarily by illegal aliens per se, but rather criminals. Criminal aliens are coming into this country. Again, our job is not to be Border Patrol. We don't want to be Border Patrol agency. If we did, we would have gone to work for the U.S. government a long time ago. But that's not our job. Our job, again, is to prevent terrorists from coming into the country. Our job is also to talk about border insecurity, the problems around the border. And my thing has always been this. If you don't live on the border, if you live 25 miles or more away from the border, you really don't know what's happening on the border. We've challenged some congressmen to come to the border and we'll show them what we're talking about. They have indeed come to the border. And they were under the false impression that the border is protected by AWAC planes, by sensors, and by F-16s and everything. It's not. Anybody can come across the Rio Grande River into our country at any time without detection. And again, I'm not talking about people coming to work at restaurants or hotels or ranches or whatever. I'm talking about people that are coming in here armed with automatic weapons, escorting 15 or 20 other individuals. To me, that's not a person coming to look for work at a restaurant or hotel. That's somebody that can afford to pay $15,000 or $20,000 to be brought across the border. So again, the border, as far as we're concerned, is very wide open, very porous, and very unprotected. It's extremely vulnerable. The border, again, has very minimal law enforcement presence. And between the ports of entry, the criminal enterprise rules. In Mexico, they call that area their turf. They call it their plazas. You got to pay to be able to smuggle anything across their plazas in Mexico. So the Mexican side of the river is governed or protected by these cartels. So on our side, between the ports of entry, really the criminal enterprise rules. There's a picture right there of Sheriff Danny Dominguez in Presidio County, in one of the crossings there in his county. That's what it looks like. You can tell right there to the right of his feet where there's tire tracks of vehicles that go out by there every single day, going back and forth to Mexico. It's not a port of entry, at least not a legal port of entry. That's exactly what's happening. So we face many problems. We share a lot of problems. Drug and human smuggling. We also have a problem with trash along that's left on properties. Landowners calling us as sheriffs, telling the sheriff, please do something about these people coming across my land, leaving all this trash, where my cows will later eat it and die. It's costing me a lot of money. What about the gates that are being torn down, the fences that are being cut? These are landowners that come to us. We are the ones that have to respond to what's happening. We're all seeing problems of incursion. Whether we want to admit it or not, they may not be military, I don't know, but they are. Whenever people come across in camouflage clothing, very clean cut, in very good physical condition, with backpacks on their backs and machine guns slung on their shoulders, as far as I'm concerned, that's some type of military or military-trained people. So we deal with incursions along the border. We deal with what we call the violent narco-terrorist groups, based on the definition I gave you about the FBI. These are people that cause havoc. They create a lot of problems for a lot of innocent people on the U.S. side of the border. We also have communication problems. With, and a lot of these problems that I'm talking about, some of them are we're seeing, hopefully, some the light at the end of the tunnel with help from the governor's office, with help from the 80th legislative session, some funding that was made available to us. But again, we see many things along the border, in the border also. This here are some pictures, and I was not aware that this was going to be an open meeting, but it's okay. I think everything has been published before anyway, and I was not aware that news media may be in the room also, but again, that's okay. These are pictures that were sent to us from Mexico. These are pictures of gang members that control the trains from southern Mexico all the way to Monterrey, and then from Monterrey to Laredo, to McAllen, to El Paso, and to other areas across the state of Texas. On those trains there, as you can see in those pictures, are members of MS-13, and they control those trains. You want to get on that train, that's no problem. You can get on that train, but it's going to cost you. You see the picture in the bottom, the middle picture in the bottom, you see one individual there, barely can see him, he's got the hand signs. SMS-13 gang signs. The picture of the on the left of the screen of the females there, part of the fee in most cases of getting on that train is sexual assault. When they get to the border, who has to deal with those people? We do. We're the ones that have to deal with those people. Now, my reason for being here today is not only to tell you what problems we have along the border, and I say we as law enforcement, the law enforcement community, but some of these problems are also seen by Parks and Wildlife. The danger of Parks and Wildlife being out there on the border, it's there. It's happened many times where boats have been shot at from Mexico with Border Patrol. Within time, it's going to happen for game wardens also. We're seeing again the statistics for OTMs other than Mexicans. This is for fiscal year old 330,147. A year later, 44,614. A year later, 165,168. This is just other than Mexicans.
What does that mean? I'm sorry.
Other than Mexicans.
Other
than
coming across.
Coming from countries, and I've got the figures from countries they're from Middle Eastern countries, from Latin American countries, from Horn of Africa, from
that,
countries
that
are very...
Is that the border or just Texas?
That's just the Texas border. I'm sorry, that's the U.S. border.
U.S.
Southwestern border. That's the southwestern border. The five sectors, border patrol sectors along the southwestern border. Again, most of these people come across as immigrants from countries of special interest that were apprehended along the southern border of our country, for example, Afghanistan, Algeria, China, Ethiopia, Iran, Iraq, North Korea, Sudan, Syria, and many other countries. The Rio Grande Valley sector of Border Patrol, for example, saw a 61% increase in human smuggling cases with 76 MS-13 gang members arrested, 55 assaults against U.S. Border Patrol agents. Since then, I think their assaults are up like 3,000% against Border Patrol agents. Our information is that a lot of these individuals are being smuggled across or smuggled into Texas or into the United States are being told you need to start fighting it out with Border Patrol agents or Texas officers or whomever, but you need to start fighting them. We need to start showing them, in other words, that we're serious about smuggling and we're not going to stop. We need for them to back down, for us to back down. 2005 saw a 3,000% increase in Chinese immigrants, also a tremendous increase in the seizure of Chinese heroin. This is just in the Rio Grande Valley sector alone. It's my understanding that the mafia members and the Chinese mafia have determined that the best place to do smuggling is southern Texas. It's the best place to do it. So this is why they've moved their operations to the southern part of Texas. Vulnerabilities along the border. In the summer of 2006, we had information from 50 persons from the Horn of Africa were contracting with Mexican gangs to be smuggled into the United States. They're willing to pay $20,000 each for safe passage into this country. They traveled through Spain to the tri-border area, which I'll talk more about in a little bit, then to Mexico. Venezuela was part of the alternate plan. Again, these are people that can afford to pay $20,000 for safe passage. And it's very hard for these people to come back into the country, into the United States, and work at restaurants and come up with $20,000. They have other intents, as far as we're concerned. In January 2007, 11 Iraqis with counterfeit passports, they paid $1,200 each in Spain. Once they got to Mexico, they were supposed to pay between $6,000 and $8,000 to be smuggled into the United States. December 2006, in Columbus, New Mexico, an individual by the name of Alfonso Salinas was questioned. It was determined that his real name was Ayman Sulman Kamal, Egyptian-born Muslim. He was trying to pass himself as an Hispanic. He was involved in Hudspeth County, Texas, in the area of Neely's Crossing, which you've heard about in January 2007, about a possible incursion there with Sheriff Arvin West. He's a narcotic smuggler confirmed the above, a narcotic smuggler was apprehended. He said, yes, there is an individual by the name of Salinas that is, in fact, smuggling Middle Eastern individuals through Neely's Crossing in Hushford County. And he has been told to keep quiet because he's going to draw a lot of problems into that area. We have federal agencies and state agencies from all over the place along the border, and we cannot afford that. He decided he was going to keep on doing it. His body was discovered later on. Apparently he did not mind the drug smugglers. He kept on doing it, and they stopped him from doing it to prevent more heat into that area. So again, these aliens that were supposed to be that were being crossed to Hushford County were taken to Venezuela, and they were taken to New York to receive legal documentation as Venezuelan citizens. They were smuggled, was subsequently killed in Mexico, possibly the Carrillo Fuentes drug trafficking organization, because human smugglers of this kind were bringing too much heat to the border. What other threats we have? Those are actual weapons that have been seized from individuals right across the border from, well, right across the Rio Grande River. This is standard issued equipment for some cartel members in Mexico, and they're hand grenades. They're grenades intended to be fired by this other type of weapon, and they are used against law enforcement in Mexico. We have been told by an individual that he provides information to us that we need to be very careful. This was 2 years ago, though, so nothing has happened yet, and I hope nothing does, but we need to be very careful because we keep putting the pressure along the border. The cartels are supposedly going to start using these weapons against us on the U.S. side also. We have gotten information that they have requested permission to assassinate some of us along the border, and the permission has been denied by higher-ranking cartel members, again, because they do not want to draw that heat to the border. However, what is there to prevent one of these individuals, low-ranking cartel members, from getting high on cocaine and doing whatever he wants to do and just killing one of us? Really didn't care to him what happens along the border. So it's not just a problem with an everyday problem with making traffic stops and things like this, but rather we also have to deal with this with the cartel members and drug traffickers and human traffickers. Right now, as far as we know, the human trafficking in our area is more lucrative than narcotics trafficking. You get more money for it. If someone tries to stop you, everybody run, you don't lose your load. That's like you with narcotics. This weapons was seized in Matamoros in February 2007 by the Mexican Army, supposedly or possibly to be used in the in case there was a trial for Fidel Cardenas Guillen in Matamoros in Brownsville, Texas. Some border threats also. Improvised explosive devices found in Laredo, Texas, January 2006. December 30, 2005 in Cameron County, Texas. Border patrol agents were shot at. Their boat was struck several times. It happens often. January 2006, at Ceniso, Texas, just south of Laredo, Texas, there was a sniper from Mexico firing for 3 days at cameras and at border patrol agents along the riverbank. In Starr County, Texas, July 13, 2006, there was 300 to 400 shots fired at deputies and border patrol agents that had gone to the river to investigate a possible shooting. They were shot at from the east also. So they were being shot at from Mexico and the eastern side of this country also. But the Border Patrol agents and National Guard troops were shot at in Starr County, Texas also at the same time because they were in the area just in doing investigations. February 2007, Lovington, New Mexico, a sawed-off shotgun was found, a pistol was found, and some Iraqi currency was found in a residence. Again, drug trafficking organizations visited a deputy sheriff's home in Hutchinson County, Texas, told the wife, tell your husband not to go to the riverbanks anymore or we're just going to have to deal with, you know, something's going to happen to him. So these are some of the things we're seeing. Kidnappings, we see them often. Home invasions in Cameron County, Yellow County, Starr Counties happen very often. The pseudo cops. Carjackings in Starr County happen very often where a lady comes out of the grocery store, gets in her car, puts her 2-year-old baby in the back seat of the car, starts to go to the front seat or driver's side to start driving. All somebody hits her from behind, throws her to the ground. She gets in the vehicle, or they get in the vehicle, take off towards Mexico. A lady by the name of Estela Ramirez, a long-serving justice of the peace in Zapata County, was with her daughter. She's in her 80s now, her 90s now, and she was at Rio Grande City. She starts getting in her car, and of course, very slowly, she gets thrown away from her car by two individuals. Her daughter also gets thrown from the car. She suffers a broken ankle. They take her vehicle to Mexico. Presently, she's in a very, very serious condition in a nursing home. She's never been able to recover from that incident. She's very close to death now. So these are things that happen often. We also have, of course, in January 14, 2005, 2006, the United States Department of Agriculture inspector was doing his normal duties patrolling along the riverbank when he sees 17 individuals come across the river. Three of those individuals have military boots on and automatic weapons. I think Ms. Commissioner Martin was able to hear from that inspector 2 weeks ago in Zapata, Texas, when she was there. So she actually heard it for herself, this inspector's testimony or story. So when these things happen, Edgar Aníbal Rivera Paz, who I told you about a little while ago, MS-13 gang member, high-ranking member of MS-13, he was arrested in Falfurrias, Texas, Brooks County, Texas. He's responsible for the bus bombing in the U.S. in which 28 people died, including 6 children and the wounding of 14 others. He was apprehended in Brooks County, Texas, in February 2005. He has been deported at least 4 times. He has vowed to shoot it out with police officers next time he is stopped. Since then, and even since April 2006, we have information that he's on his way back. And this time he's not going to be taken alive. Border threats, July 1st, 2006, a Stark County Sheriff's detention officer, Benema Gilberto Hernandez Jr., goes to Mexico to visit his girlfriend. And Commissioner Martin also heard from Sheriff Guerra when they were there last week. He goes to visit his girlfriend. There's no problem. He's just a detention officer. He's not a peace officer. He's going to go visit his girlfriend across the river in Roma. His body was found July 3rd, 2 days later, in Mexico. He had been shot through the head. His hands had been bound behind his back. His eyes and head had been bandaged with duct tape. And he had been beaten and tortured prior to being shot. He was a law enforcement officer as far as cartels were concerned. And perhaps we cannot go to Mexico, we cannot go to the United States to harm you guys, but you come over here, we're going to show you, we'll teach you what we can do to you. Leave us alone, in other words. During his funeral, his funeral was taking place at a funeral home in Rio Grande City, across the street, one of 2 kidnappings that day was occurring. The suspect, a Mexican national, was wanted for a homicide he had committed there in that same area a year before. Commit his kidnapping, go back to Mexico, his murder, go back to Mexico. In order to threats, May 2006 information was received by my office that cartels immediately across our border were planning or threatening to kill as many police officers as possible on the United States side of the river. Again, why? They want for us to get away from the border, and basically to them, all law enforcement on the border is fair game. You're in our way, we need to get you out of here. Again, it's just planned to scare us away from the border. It's very possible these cartels may form a nexus, which we think they already have, with members of Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations, since they own the plazas, again, the area in Mexico, their turf. It's owned by them. If you're going to smuggle somebody from the Middle East or a possible cartel member, well, you're going to have to get permission from this cartel member to bring them across. And as far as we know, it's happening. So that's telling us that these cartel members are aware of what's happening and they don't care. So I'm going to pay them their fee, pay them their tax. There's an incident happened in Three Rivers, Texas, where some individuals, supposedly from Iraq, purchased a whole bunch of hunting equipment, leased some property there, went hunting, or rather pretended to go hunting, bought a whole bunch of new camping equipment, went hunting there, never pulled their equipment out of the trucks, were there for a little while, burned all their equipment and took off. I mean, I'm not much of a hunter, I don't have time for hunting anymore, but perhaps some of you people are hunters and some of you people own property, I'm sure. You don't just buy a whole bunch of equipment and just burn it. Most of the time it's put to use. These people didn't care about these things. Another border threat that we saw in Jim Hawk County, Texas, is patches were found in a path used by human smugglers. These patches, again, are something similar to the red patch there with the lion's head with some wings on it and a parachute on top of the wing's head and the lion's head and some Arabic writing on it. The news media questioned FBI about this. Where are these patches from? Who do they belong to? Well, we don't know. We're going to get an analysis, okay? Will tell us, and they never did find out where these patches came from. So one of the news conferences, Border Patrol Chief David Aguilar, who's a friend of ours, was being questioned by a reporter. He was asked about these patches. He says the jackets that were found with patches were not from Al-Qaeda, but they were from countries where Al-Qaeda is known to operate. And as far as I'm concerned, if these patches come from a country where Al-Qaeda is known to operate, I would assume that these patches belong to a country that is friends to Al-Qaeda. And why are these patches found 50 miles from the border, or less than 50 miles from the border, in an area in a path used by human smugglers? Why are they hidden there on a jacket? Board of Threats. Again, you saw what during this patches. What I did is that I never was able to get a good response from anybody about what this patches really meant. So since we started our coalition, I've been getting a lot of anonymous calls from federal agents. I get a lot of copies of reports from federal agencies. Things that our government supposedly is doing when in fact they're not. And I've been able to develop some friends along the way. One of them came from Egypt. One of them is a member of the Israeli military intelligence. So I sent him an email with copies of this patches or pictures of this patches, and I said, what do these patches mean to you guys there in the Middle East? And the individual from Egypt says that this patch, the red one, meant sacrifice is the way to paradise. Shahid Jihad, which means striving holy war or holy war to the death. The lion's head in Iran, Iraq, Syria, and the Ethiopian Somalia region, Al-Qaeda training camps in Somalia, that's where it's used to. An individual from the United States, an expert in terrorism, gave me this information. These patches belong to defense platoons. He who dies in the line of duty protecting the homeland is rewarded with heaven for eternity. They are also used by commando platoons, and they use parachutes in their patches. In other words, they're suicide bombers or suicide terrorists. Israel, information from Israel, this patch of special commando units wear these patches. They are headquartered in France, and they're Islamic mercenaries. This individual here, I think he's from Israel also. It's self-sacrifice, the way for eternal life is by suicide. Islamic terrorists, again, possibly from Iran or Islamics like Al-Qaeda, are committed to carrying out a suicide bombing attack on a global scale. And he told me, beware. His email, the word email, is just like it is right there. It was capitalized, bolded, with an exclamation mark. He says, be careful. Something's getting ready to happen. Fortunately, again, it's been 3 years. And again, fortunately, nothing has happened. Why? I think, based on the information that we get, is because of the governor's funding. Because the money is given to us by Governor Perry, through Mr. McCraw, and through the legislature, that we have been able to show that we can have or make a difference along the border and prevent these people from coming into the country. What we've done also because of what we've done through the governor's office with Texas Intelligence Council, which Governor Perry appointed me to, is that we're trying to get with Mr. McCraw, we're trying to get all local, state, and federal agencies together. I tell them, let's work together. Let's get things done. Let's work as one law enforcement family in protecting this country. So we sent all our information over to the governor's office, or to the State Operations Center, actually the Border Security Operations Center, which was also created by Governor Perry. We send all our information, and then every day it's disseminated back to all of us, just on a daily basis, to all local agencies, federal agencies, state agencies. Everybody knows what's going on across the border. And I took, just at random, I picked one of these reports up. I said, let me see what happened in just one 24-hour period along the border, just for the heck of it. And I happened to have picked November 28, 2006. It's from 6:30 p.m. November 27, 2006 to November 28, 2006. In Uvalde County, there was one Somalian immigrant arrested. In Comstock, Texas, at a checkpoint, there was one Iran arrested. In Del Rio, Texas, one Iranian arrested. One Pakistani arrested in Del Rio. The subject was released. One MS-13 gang member in Eagle Pass. One, two Somalians in Uvalde. One MS-13 gang member from Honduras captured in Cotula, Texas. Number 8, U.S. Border Patrol agents assigned to the El Paso, Texas station assisted the El Paso Police Department in their search for two unidentified individuals who assaulted a security guard at a water plant near the border. Customs and Border Protection, ANM also participated in the search. El Paso Police Department later learned that one of the individuals had wrestled an unloaded gun away from the security guard and attempted to shoot him. Individual then fled to Mexico. We have been told since September 12th or 13th, 2001, watch your water plants. Watch those areas, your airports, your malls and everything else. They could be vulnerable. But why would these individuals be in a water plant in El Paso, Texas, in the middle of the night, and they get caught there instead of just fleeing, jumping the fence, where they try to wrestle a handgun away from a security guard and try to kill him? Could it possibly be there would be no witnesses? Number 15, U.S. Border Patrol agents in McAllen was assaulted while attempting to arrest one male subject from Mexico. The subject resisted arrest, attempted to punch the agent, and also attempted to grab the agent's gun during the struggle. One individual from Burma was caught in Yellow County, Texas. In Kingsville, U.S. Border Patrol agents in Kingsville, a Guatemalan member of the Texas Syndicate was apprehended. U.S. Border agents arrested one male subject from Mexico near Fear, Texas. The subject is an aggravated felon with a criminal history that includes accessory to murder. This is just one 24-hour period. Just one 24-hour period. Incursions. March 3rd, 2005, one of my deputy sheriffs within a surveillance mission encountered 20 to 25 individuals marching in a cadence, two abreast in BDUs, very clean cut, good physical condition, carrying duffel bags, backpacks, automatic weapons slung across their shoulders. And Commissioner Martin also heard from this deputy sheriff, or former deputy sheriff of mine, last week that she was in Zapata. Are we lying about it? Well, I don't know. That seems to have been that there were a lot of other people that saw the same thing, though. Again, residents are always reporting soldiers getting off of boats. Husband County, Texas, we all saw this also, where individuals try to stop an individual with an SUV, drives back across the river into Husband County. I'm sure Mr. Brown heard this from Kay Fox and everywhere else when this incident happened.
Right.
Commissioner Brown, I'm sure there was a lot of controversy, a lot of debate about it, but it did happen. Again, there's a video camera that on a DPS patrol car showing what happened. Besides pictures. Sometimes we're told, we don't believe you guys. Well, here's pictures. What do you have to say now? Here are the pictures.
One of the things, didn't they, on the other side, they were wearing military-looking uniforms?
If you look there, Commissioner Brown and Commissioner, if you look there towards just off to the right of the center of the screen there, you see a Humvee there.
Yeah.
And behind those bushes there, you see what we say are soldiers in BDU.
Yeah.
And what we did, and this has not been said yet, but I'll say it anyway. We've testified to this, and the media hasn't caught it yet. Well, we send some of these photographs to a federal agency to evaluate for us and to do some inspecting and things. And this are, I guess, new technology that federal agencies are using. That they determined that the Mexican press and Mexican military were saying that's not our vehicle. We don't use those vehicles, and those are not our soldiers. You know, they're not dressed that way. I think those were U.S. soldiers dressed as Mexican soldiers to try to make us look bad. And remember when that hit the media? Well, we sent these photographs to be analyzed, and we were told by a very reputable federal agency that those pictures, or that Humvee and those soldiers were in fact military vehicles from Mexico. So that ended our debate there. Also, because of the funding we have seen again from the governor's office, and well, in this case, the governor's office, back in 2006, 2007, because of what we're doing along the border, in a partnership with Parks and Wildlife, with DPS, with Border Patrol and everybody else, this is something that we have seen along the border. Drug seizures. And this is an 11 and a half month period. 407,000 pounds of marijuana valued at $1,629,000,000. 33 pounds of methamphetamine. And this is again ending 2007. Since then, if you've been reading or keeping up with the media, I don't recall exactly what percentage of the increase we've seen in methamphetamine smuggling from Mexico. There's been a tremendous increase in methamphetamine smuggling. Heroin, 104 pounds. Cocaine, 94 pounds. Money seizures, over $14 million in money seizures. And because of what we're doing along the border, adding drug seizures, values, and cash seizures, interagency coordination, law enforcement agency efforts, we have it's resulted rather in depriving the criminal enterprise of nearly $1.8 billion since the establishment of the Texas Border Security Operations Center. And the Texas Border Security Operations Center, again, was formed because we sheriffs wanted to work along with everybody else, and Governor Perry listened to us, and Governor Perry ordered the opening of the Border Security Operations Center, and these are the results of what's happening along our border. We have seen many smuggling and criminal groups that have been identified. We have seen through the efforts, again, of working together, that gang members out of Houston, gang members out of the Fort Worth area, Dallas area, you know, I mean, it affects everybody. You know, it affects people from, you know, Amarillo and Fort Worth, El Paso, and everywhere else. It's related to the border. It's going to affect everybody in Texas. So we've been able to identify many smuggling groups out of Houston that are working along the area of the border. Namely, in our area, go to Starr County, Zapata County, Webb County, Jim Hawk County. They're picking up aliens, they're picking up human smugglers, or rather human smugglers, and picking up narcotics. Also, because of our efforts, we've seen many auto theft rings that have been busted in many counties, including Jackson County. Because of our efforts, Jackson County has seen a reduction in auto theft, or have seen an increase in the seizure of stolen vehicles from the Houston area. Namely, F-250 pickup trucks, F-350 pickup trucks, and things like that. Again, to the government's initiatives, we formed the Border Security Operations Center. I say we. We formed the Texas Border Security Operations Center. We've also formed Border Operations, that is law enforcement agencies from sheriff's offices, police departments, state agencies, are great partners. And I'm not saying this because I'm here today with you, but are great partners of the Texas Navy. You know, the state law enforcement off the highways, you know, the game wardens. Like we talk about Border Patrol, we don't know what we would do without them. Tremendous help to us. You know, all formed TDEX. The government's offices formed TDEX, which was some type of controversy last legislative session, but it's a big help to a lot of agencies in Texas.
What is it? What's TDEX?
What that is, Sherman Holt, is that the government's office created TDEX through a contractor, and all our information that we gather in Texas, all our computer systems in our offices, be it in Dallas Police Department, I don't know if they're online or not, but I'm saying this as an example, Zapata County Sheriff's Office, Texas DPS, everything goes into one computer system. And you could be sitting there in Dallas and say, let me punch in this name here, if Peter Holt, and see if there's any record. Not a record, but rather, we just found out Peter Holt got a ticket in Dallas last night. What is he doing over there? And then now we seize his vehicle in Zapata with a load of narcotics. Anyway, in other words, we're able to tie everything together and find out. This is hypothetical, Commissioner Martin.
We want to talk to you later.
Watch what we're going to have, and I take that back. Watch what we're going to have San Antonio Express. That's hypothetical.
And I understand a lot of this is just being brought aboard. Is it starting to work?
It's been on board now for about a year, year and a half.
Okay. And
It's working. Okay. It's working. Border operations are working. They're continuous. Since September 2000, we actually started in November 2006, the sheriffs, and then of course DPS came along with Operation Wrangler, Operation Rubicon, and Operation Wranglers 2, 3, and 4, and then Operation Border Star, which is ongoing now, involves all state agencies, federal agencies, local agencies, again working together with one common goal. We have the Border Security Operations Center that's also working, LifeScan. When I was invited to join Texas Intelligence Council, Mr. McCraw was going to purchase a whole bunch of LifeScan machines, which is fingerprint machines that you put in jails in different parts of the state. Normally what you do, you grab a fingerprint card, which, you know, we've all seen on television, you go out and take everybody's fingerprint, send it off to Austin, and they send it off to the FBI, and 3 or 4 weeks later we have a response. Hey, yeah, this guy was caught, or this guy's name is not this name, it's this other name, and he's a terrorist. And Mr. McCraw was going to put this machines, the LifeScan machines, which you take the fingerprint on the machine itself, and you get a response within 15, 20 seconds. And he was going to put this machine, I think, in East Texas and things. I said, wait a minute, Steve, why don't we start it off at the border where we have the most need for him? And sure enough, Mr. McCraw, again, through the efforts of Governor Perry, you know, he placed them all along the border first. We also, of course, license plate readers are still they're still being used, they're still being studied. You have license plate readers in different areas along the border, a vehicle stolen in Houston. The report is made right away, it goes to the system right away. By the time you get to Del Rio, or the time you get to El Paso, or Rio Grande City, Star County, whatever, before it crosses Mexico, if they have not removed the license plates, that license plate reader will automatically read it and give you an alert, hey, that vehicle's here, watch it, it's getting ready to cross. Interoperability, I know the government's office is working on an $80 million, I think it was appropriated for the last legislative session, for operability. Right now we're fortunate to have communication with game wardens in Zapata. Some areas in the state, they don't have communications with the sheriff's office because of interoperability. That is going to really change again through the efforts of the governor's office into the next legislative session. Texas Intelligence Council, again, I've discussed, and we have a lot of communication now between federal, state, and local agencies. One thing I will tell you, October 2006, Mr. Robert Mueller, San Antonio, Texas, he was questioned about the terrorism, about possible problems along the border. This is his quote. We have indications that leaders of other terrorist groups may be contemplating assuming the identities of others and trying to get across the border. It is intelligence that indicates there have been discussions on that. The FBI previously busted a ring organized by the terrorist group Hezbollah that had operatives across the Mexican border to carry out possible terrorist attacks inside the United States. Robert Mueller again continues to say individuals from countries with known al-Qaeda connections have attempted to enter the United States illegally, using alien smuggling rings and assuming Hispanic appearances. Hezbollah cell has been dismantled after officials discovered that the terror organization was smuggling operatives across the United States-Mexico border, trying to carry out a terror attacks inside the United States. Then Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Peter Pace, said this, Of course, he became chairman later on, and just last year was dismissed by the Bush administration. Hamas has joined Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda in the triple frontier zone in Latin America, where the borders of Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay can convey. There, the Islamic terror groups train recruits, gather intelligence and targets, launder money, and sell drugs. There is evidence that these terrorists and narco-terrorists will soon migrate north into the United States. As far as we know, that has already happened. In summary, the sheriffs along the southwestern border answer the 911 calls from our constituents in rural America. We are the ones they call. And again, not because they're here, but the next people we call when we get complaints about landowners is game wardens, because they're the ones that know that area better than we do sometimes. We're the first responders at the expense of getting local taxpayers. Our federal government is not subsidizing us in any way, shape, or form. There cannot be homeland security without border security. And it doesn't matter what party you're with or anything like that. This is what we understand to be a red, white, and blue issue. It doesn't matter what party affiliation you're from. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what it is. It's a red, white, and blue issue that we all need to really be very, very concerned with. Operation Linebacker to us is an initiative that puts law enforcement, puts us in the driver's seat instead of the cartels, the smugglers, or the border crossing entrepreneurs. We don't want to give up the driver's seat. On the Texas border, we have no right, we have no choice. We've had to pick up the fight to save our counties. We didn't ask for the battle on the border, but again, we refuse to lose to criminals. We cannot give that land, our area, away to criminals. And I'm not talking immigration-wise here. I'm talking criminal-wise. I want to thank you for everything you do for Texas, for all the work you do for everybody, for Parks and Wildlife. This last session was something that was unprecedented as far as we're concerned. The governor asked for $100 million, and the legislature gave him $110 million. Parks and Wildlife, and I'm not here to speak for the colonel or anybody else, but I know for a fact that Parks and Wildlife does need some funding also. I do know for a fact that working with Governor Perry, working with Mr. McCraw, I know the governor wants to give some funding, more funding to Parks and Wildlife because it's needed. We want to give, be able to get, the Parks and Wildlife get more funding. But as we all know, we can't do it alone. I spent 3.5 weeks approximately this last session here in Austin testifying, and I don't call it lobbying, but rather informing our legislators about certain things. I think that perhaps we need to work a little bit harder next time in making sure that our Texas Navy gets a little bit more funding. We've seen some great strides, and I thank you again for what you do. There's my information, and I'll be happy to try to answer any questions you all may have.
We're the ones who need to thank you, and we appreciate everything you're doing, and your folks who are out there doing it where it's all occurring, and we just want to express our appreciation, and thanks for taking the time to make that presentation. I think it was, we'll all agree, it was very enlightening, to say the least. So, thank you.
I appreciate it.
At this time, may I ask McGraw, would you like to say any words to the commission? Would that
be but Sheriff, don't go yet, because I've got a question.
Here we go. Sure.
I can start off saying that I can assure you that Colonel Pete Flores is not afraid of asking for things that his agency needs.
I was going to ask you, man.
He's not bad. We've got the invoices to prove it. I'll also say that I have to confess here, I wasn't always appreciative of the things that Texas Parks and Wildlife and the game wardens did for the state of Texas. And being a Texan, growing up in the Department of Public Safety, starting there as a highway patrolman, later in narcotics, and running off the rest of the country, playing around with the FBI for a number of years, I had no idea, first of all, the varied and vital roles that the game wardens played in Parks and Wildlife. And I was up in Paladura Canyon. I had some appreciation of what the play of Texas, and ran into a few game wardens and enough to behave when I was out hunting. But I never really understood, in terms of that Texas Navy thing, what that meant, you know, in the Katrina, and their law enforcement skills, and they go on the ground and know how to operate in a hostile environment, and in fact were the ones involved in several rescue missions, you know, long before, you know, the federal government or anybody else showed up in New Orleans. So I have a great, tremendous respect for them. Another thing, you know, leadership matters, I reflect back. I was sitting in the same chair today talking to the governor, the same chair I was back in November. No, it was actually August of 2005. So I was reminiscing about when Siggy was talking, you know, and Siggy's not afraid of asking for things either, for the record, and made it very clear that they had this coalition, this concern, this threat. And I was sitting in that same chair as I was today talking the same thing about the governor, Board of Security, because he he's engaged, he's involved in that issue for a number of reasons. When I briefed him back initially in July of 2005, when he tasked me to at least try to quantify the most significant threat to Texas, well, it was a porous 1,254-mile border. And he had since said you can't have homeland security until you have border security. That's absolutely right. I mean, the triple threat, public safety, homeland security, and public health. We're threatened. Texans feeling in fear of their lives, you know, feeling that, you know, they ought not, the ranch foremen and ranch hands ought not to have to worry about their kids out there. They'll have to feel like they're being extorted if they don't leave their bunkhouse unlocked and fully stocked with water and food. And, you know, moreover, and I think Siggy did a great job in terms of talking about the organized smuggling activity between the ports of entry. Texas is now the transshipment center for drugs and human trafficking, period. You know, violent gangs, transnational, state-based gangs, Texas Syndicate, Mexican Mafia, Barrios Tecas, Hermanos Pistoleros, they're engaged and are the outsourced labor in Texas, and they're spreading like a virus throughout Texas and the rest of the nation. So they're no longer just in the retail market, but they're in child prostitution, et cetera. And you've seen the threat. They did a great job. It relates to the other part, 492 special interest aliens. You know, individuals from known countries of Al-Qaeda presence. Texas alone, arrested since March of 2006, trying to get into Texas. So I think you've got a good appreciation of what that threat is. Certainly the governor did, but what do you do? Well, fortunately, leaders like Siggy Gonzalez and his other sheriffs, you know, go back to this old police axiom. You know, if you increase patrols in high crime areas, it doesn't matter whether it's urban, New York City, as Chief Bratton did when he was the chief of the police in New York City, or it doesn't matter whether you're in Los Angeles, Houston, it doesn't matter. You increase patrols, you decrease crime. That's organized criminal activity as well, because this is, make no mistake about it, it's about making money. They don't care, there are no jihadists down there for working for the Gulf cartel or the Sinaloa cartel. They're profit motivated, plain and simple. And if you take that police axiom and you apply overwhelming presence and you own that territory, you deny it from the criminal element, you're going to shut down organized smuggling activities, and guess what? I mean, Texans are going to feel safer. And the rest of the nation and the rest of the state is going to be thankful for it, because what happens on the border doesn't stay at the border. It goes throughout every region in Texas, and the smallest towns up in Dalhar, Texas, are impacted by Mexican methamphetamine. Plain and simple. So it's a good public policy, but the concern the governor had is when you look at the world's changed so much, how do you organize? You know, we've got 2,632 different law enforcement agencies in Texas, local, okay? Add on the state, add on the federal agencies, you know, Border Patrol, they got five different sectors in Texas. ICE has four, FBI's got four. Everyone rearranges the state of Texas in different geographical boundaries. How do you organize and unify those efforts so you can maximize the impact? And make no mistake about it, this is not a Border Patrol gap. The Border Patrol, brave men of the Border Patrol have been sacrificing. They're out there. This is a Washington, D.C. not investing in border security for decades. This is a 30-year, 40-year sin. And they're out there. They're under-equipped. They're understaffed. You know, when they even get to 18,000, that magic number, guess what? It doesn't, you know, immediately everything's perfect. We've got a long ways to go if they're properly staffed and resourced. Until then, you know, what's the governor to do? You know, what's a commission to do that oversees, you know, Texas Parks and Wildlife, when you're looking in the face of these things, and you have to look at in terms of all the missions you have and how do you prioritize and unify efforts, and that's really what, you know, back in February of 2006 was about. And working with our colleagues, taking these ideas, teamwork approach, working with Border Patrol, see if we can centralize intelligence or information so we got an idea what that threat is. Number two, hey, how about centralizing, you know, not just that, but coordination? Makes sense. You got the sheriffs, you know, patrolling here, the game wardens over here. You don't want them duplicating that effort. So if you require, but to do this is an entire sea change in law enforcement thinking, because it's no longer move a Border Patrol inspection station 20 miles back and then play catch. You know, but once they've already crossed the border, you've already lost, okay? They've already penetrated in that area. They've already, you know, you've already given up a piece of Texas is what you've done to the smugglers. And as a result, what we saw is a 17.2% increase in violent crime in every border county. I mean, the average of border counties from El Paso County to Camden County. At the same time, the rest of Texas was dropping by 2%. So how do you do that? So you invested money. The state legislature came through with money, additional resources, and as a result, you know. You all are taxpayers like us. We don't want to get in. Who wants to be involved in an initiative that's just you're spending money and there's really no impact? But I can say that the sheriffs deserve this credit. I can say the game wardens deserve this credit. And Border Patrol deserves this credit. Working together, they reduced violent crime by 65%. And you can't make that up. It's huge. And that's from the third quarter. That's the third quarter of November of 05 and the third quarter of 07. And we don't have the latest statistics right now. There's also a 45% decrease in that same time period in illegal alien apprehensions. Now, why is that important? We don't care about capturing. We care about preventing. A 45% reduction. You saw the numbers that Sheriff Gonzalez had up there, 185,000 southwest border. Texas had more OTMs than anybody else, more SIAs than anybody else. But guess what? Those numbers, you know, that he looked, you know, we've talked about now in the Texas, they're down to the 80,000s in Texas. Tremendous drop, 45% drop, and it's even more in different counties. Why? Because they're about profit. They don't want to lose their particular money. So the message I have is that you know, sometimes it's when you look at and you're overseeing organizations, you're wondering how things go. Leadership matters, and I tell you what, this organization's got excellent leadership, starting right with this commission right here and the support that you've given them. Because it's really hard for law enforcement to think of, and you heard the colonel talk about it. That's why, you know, you get excited. Prevention. You know, if they don't come across, you don't have to arrest, indict, convict, and seize. If you can prevent them, that's the way to go. That's a new law enforcement way of looking at things. We're more about solving the crime than preventing the crime. And what the game wardens did, or Texas Parks and Wildlife, they adjusted their entire mission, recognizing they had to steal resources and divert them from every other location. And I know if I found something else, everybody wants a game warden. Every county judge, everyone wants a game warden in their county. So yet, you know, the organization willing to take the heat, divert resources, and this is a sacrifice to the troops. They're being deployed down there, you know, hardship assignments, working the 12-hour shifts along those lines, and in hostile territories on the river. You know, game wardens aren't afraid to get on the river. Get on the lakes. And so really, you know, my only statement is to say that, hey, we've clearly made progress. We're not where we need to be. But every dime that the state of Texas has invested in the game wardens and Texas Parks and Wildlife is an investment in Homeland Security. So I want to thank you and thank the Colonel and the rest of his leadership team.
Well, I appreciate it. And thank you for coming and saying all of that. Because, and obviously one of our worries as a commission is we have to worry about beating his guys. You know, are they getting the resources? Do they have the training? Do they have the background? Because most of them didn't sign up for border security. Okay? And so Pete and I, as we talk, these are the things. So I appreciate you two coming in and taking your time this afternoon to help us understand kind of the broader picture. Because obviously I have constituents, this commission, Texas Parks and Wildlife, constituents, as you said, that want, you know, they want a game warden to be a game warden in their county doing what game wardens normally and traditionally have done.
Absolutely.
And, you know, obviously they'll understand for some period of time that a game warden needs to be down on the border or be working the river or working the Intercoastal Canal or whatever, but not longer term. And that's where we've had to, you know, take some time to educate. So you've now helped me when I talk to my constituents and our constituents. So I appreciate you coming in.
That's helpful. On behalf of Governor Perry, he wanted me to at least convey his thanks to what they do on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And Sheriff, thank you for taking your time and effort and coming a long way. And any questions for the Sheriff? Obviously, one of the questions I had was, is it getting better?
It's getting better. What we have, Mr. Chairman, is it one thing I'll add, like Mr. McCross said, and would you also, your comments also regarding constituents, the Parks and Wildlife, the game wardens going out there to do their job as game wardens.
Mm-hmm.
My biggest thing in Zapata, like Mr. McCross, is a reduction of crime, deterrence.
Yeah.
I would much rather prevent a burglar than trying to catch a burglar.
Right.
And what we're doing, because of high police presence, we're information we get from Mexico, from cartels to informants, is don't go to Zapata County. And it's not just sheriff's office, but it's, again, just Parks and Wildlife. Because when we had one of our operations, they had 12 boats up there.
Okay.
and it's deterrence. Unfortunately, we're sending them somewhere else, like to Stark County, in some instances. But then we have other things for Stark County that's being done also to assist. What the game wardens are doing out there also is going out there and doing a job as game wardens. And they do operations in Falcon Lake several times a year, regular operations. And when we're doing our operations, they go do their operations also at the same time. They're still doing the job as game wardens, but the presence is there where the smugglers will say, wait a minute, we can't afford to lose this loads. Mm-hmm. So really, like for your constituents, they're just doing their normal duties. One thing that does worry me, though, and very briefly touched this a little while ago, is that, again, the brazenness of this cartel members, it's getting a little bit bad. So again, I do have some concerns as to their safety. They've always had problems, but as to their safety also, again, works out there in the lake. I have two boats, one boat actually that's sitting there, and it's not being used. Mm-hmm. It's a county boat. And I don't use because I won't allow my deputies to get out there in the river or Falcon Lake because I don't want them to get out there and get hurt with these cartel members. And I know that's something that perhaps it's not wise to say, but it's the truth. And Mr. McCraw mentioned that also. They have to do it on a daily basis.
Right.
But we're going to do it, I think. Yeah.
I wanted to thank you. I've known Sheriff for many years, and you've been a champion in getting the message out and being a part of just getting everyone together in the Border Coalition. And it was great last week in Zapata. And I also want to thank Mr. McGraw with the governor's office. I think they've heard from me many times on my situations that I've encountered. But last week, to be at that meeting at the legislative visit, and when I turned around and saw a room full of agents from so many different agencies all together, working together, I looked back in the room, I thought, now truly this is a force to be reckoned with. And they are a support to each other that is tremendous. And I want to thank all three gentlemen here for, you know, just all of the partnership. Because it truly was. It was great to look back and see that room the way it was. And I can say, you know, that makes the difference when you see everybody as a team supporting each other. And Mr. McGraw, you know, I think you've heard many times, I've had many instances on my ranch where I've had personal encounters with drug dealers, MS-13s, illegals, and there is a drop. And there are actually times I can go out to my ranch and not have a confrontation, and that's a good feeling. You've had a good day when you don't have a confrontation out there. So the governor's initiatives are definitely working, and I see it firsthand. And Colonel, you know, I called 911 once. I don't call 911 any longer. I call my game warden and say, help, and then from there I'll make calls along the way, because like you said, they know where you are. They know the ranches, they know the landowners, and then he knows who to call to get help to me as quick as possible. So from a personal standpoint, I can say that it has been effective and working. And again, thank you, Sheriff, for taking the lead on this, too.
Thank you. You're welcome to go back to Zapata anytime you want.
You know, I'll...
thank you, Sheriff.
Just
thank you.
Have fuel in the boat, and I'll be there.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
If I may add, just in closing, I thank you both for being here, and certainly I do appreciate, and so do our men and women out in the field, the support from this commission and support from our executive office. We take our operations and our security extremely seriously, and we have been able to improve our equipment in the field, both personal protection and as far as personal weaponry. I think we're pretty much almost second to none in those categories. We have I'm very proud of our leadership, our captains and our majors in the field, who take a frontline approach in leadership. And when make sure that our operations run without a hitch, and work very closely with our sheriffs and the Border Patrol and the Highway Patrol. We the bottom line here is that we always have to remember that the law enforcement profession, whether it's on the border or whether it's in Texarkana, is an inherently dangerous business. And it could happen on the border, or it could happen walking into a 7-Eleven to buy a cup of coffee. But we all of us take a solemn oath to serve and protect. Our mission is conservation law enforcement. We chose to do that instead of enforcing the traffic laws. That's our, first of all, our passion. We chose, but we were also, our oath as peace officers working together, that's what this, I hope this presentation relayed. But game warden is what, as the sheriff said, that's what we're doing in the field and helping in this totality of the mission. If I can answer any further questions, if not, thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank everybody's taking time. Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Okay. We're on to item number two, Public Lands Proclamation, Hunter Recruitment Event. Permission to publish.
Lynn Campbell.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, for the record, I'm Linda Campbell, and I'm a Wildlife Division Program Director for Private Lands and Public Hunting. Today I will brief you on proposed changes to regulations governing public hunting for 2008-2009. Our first item that I'd like to discuss creates a mentored hunting permit for participants attending hunter recruitment workshops on our wildlife management areas. This is something that our folks in the field have wanted to do for some time, and so we are seeking rule changes to allow this. This permit will allow public access to our wildlife management areas to participate for participants to attend a workshop and subsequent mentored hunt associated with the workshop. It establishes a $25 permit fee for that purpose. We have pilot events planned for the upcoming hunting season. Five WMAs have indicated interest in hosting these events. So the events will occur on Chaparral, Daughtry, Justin Hurst and Nanny Stringfellow, Caddo Lake, and Alizan Bayou. And these are the staff people that have indicated interest in holding these events.
Can I stop you right there, Linda? Sorry.
Yes, sir.
I made a comment. Are you talking about the mentored hunts?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes,
okay,
sir.
So
yes.
I just...
No problem. These mentored hunts following, the mentored hunts are part of the educational event.
Right.
Okay, so they will follow the event for those that participate in these events. So the hunts that are proposed right now include hunts for dove, squirrel, other small game, and feral hog. Just to let you know, I have submitted a grant to the Hunting Heritage Partnership Program of the National Shooting Sports Foundation. In the amount of $13,000, we don't know if we've been awarded this grant or not, but hopefully if we are fortunate enough to be granted that this funding will help offset the cost of putting on these events as well. We anticipate 20 to 30 people perhaps attending these. The idea is to also look for local sponsors to also offset event costs. We intend to evaluate these pilot events and document our success with these to create a model for future events on other WMAs in the future. The workshops are specifically targeting new and lapsed hunters, and we feel like these events will integrate well with the ongoing educational activities that our WMAs now provide. We are focusing on this target audience because it is a high priority for TPW, i.e. hunter recruitment and retention is a very high priority for the agency, as is outreach to urban audiences. The second item has to do with waiving the access fee access requirement for persons entering a wildlife management area as a spectator for hunting dog field trials. Under the current rule, a field trial permit serves as a WMA access permit for dog handlers, officials, and judges for these events, but spectators are required to possess a limited use permit or an annual public hunting permit. The field trial groups have requested that the rules be changed to allow spectators to be covered under the field trial permit. Just to let you know of the extent of this, the department issues an average of about 2 field trial permits per year on our WMAs, and they're attended by approximately 80 spectators or so. So, of the field trial permit varies from $100 to $500 per day, depending on the number of participants. So at this point, we feel like we're proposing this because we feel like it is more cost-effective, really, for the department to include spectators in the overall event permit than it would be to require them to obtain a separate access permit.
Yeah.
So that's the reasoning behind it. So with that, I'd like to answer any questions and request permission to publish.
Questions or discussion?
Question.
Commissioner Parker.
Yes, What hunting dog group? Are you talking about all hunting dog groups? Field trial purposes?
Yes, sir. Field trials. And we do have Lynn Palacios, I think, is in the room. He is our regional director in South Texas and could answer specific questions on this. Lynn, do you want to? He's more familiar with the on-the-ground operation of the field trials. So I'll ask him to.
All right, Chairman and Commissioners, my name is Len Palaszczuk. I'm Region 4 Wildlife Director for the Coast in South Texas. With these field trials, we have 2 of them usually in our region on the Justin Hurst WMA, and they're going to be Labrador hunt trials, retriever trials. Yes, and they have to bring their own domestic raised birds to use for the trial. They cannot pursue or harm any native wildlife.
Just for the record, Mr. Chairman, I hear from the bird dog community, field dog community, constantly, the fact that they have to hold their Texas Open Championships and their Texas Derby Championships in Lawton, Oklahoma, because they have approached some of our wildlife management areas about using them. Have not received, encouragement.
So we need to look at why we're losing people, I guess. Okay.
Any other questions?
Any other questions? Thank you very much. No further questions or discussion. I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Moving right along. Item number 3, ITQs and commercial marine fisheries. Ivan Wright.
Good afternoon, Commissioners, Chairman. I'm going to be here to give you a short briefing today regarding individual fishing quotas and commercial marine fisheries. Some of you may have read something or seen something about individual fishing quotas. You may have heard them called IFQs, ITQs, IQs, community fishing quotas. But all of those are basically under the umbrella of a quota-based system where an allocated share is given to a particular individual or that privilege to harvest is given to a particular individual. And I'm just going to refer to them as IFQs here today. As you all know, traditionally we manage using what we call traditional regulatory measures, and those include trip limits, area closures, time and season closures, gear restrictions such as net size, mesh size, and those kinds of things. And basically what those all do is to work to restrain the efficiency of the harvesters to keep us within a certain level of catch that we want to maintain. But it directly works at the efficiency of those people who are going out on the water to do that harvest. Quota-based systems are basically designed to remove the tragedy of commons, which is, of course, what our limited entry programs were designed to do as well. It basically keeps It limits the entry so that you're not competing against the ideal that if I don't catch that fish or if I don't harvest that resource, someone else will be out there tomorrow to harvest that resource. I've got a privilege, I've got a right, I've got a long-term interest. And of course, when you get these kinds of systems where you see this kind of scarcity and this capital buildup, you can really see these race for fishes where you've probably seen some pictures of shotgun starts, fishery starts, and it may be cut off in just a matter of hours or days. When you get that kind of thing going on, obviously you got a lot of user conflict, you end up with a lot of crowding, you end up with various safety issues because people are willing to risk their own lives and go out in periods of time when they normally wouldn't because they want to be out there trying to, they may only have a week to get their catch, and so they're out there trying to get their share. And certainly what you have in those kinds of situations is what we refer to as overcapitalization, whereby you put as much capital into your vessels that in reality there's a lot more capital invested in the whole fishery that you could basically catch that in just a shorter and shorter period of time because I'm trying to compete against the other individual to get as much of my share as I can in a very short period of time. Obviously, as we've talked about the problems with the other types of fisheries, one of the things that the IFQ brings to the table is greater economic efficiency. With greater economic efficiency, you certainly get more industry stability for the long term. You got people looking further ahead and their planning horizon is further ahead. And then ultimately, and what we're here about is the ecological health that you can get, the gains in resource that you can gain by having people in these kinds of systems. I'm going to just highlight a couple of a few systems here. We're not going to talk about all these today. Y'all probably breathe a sigh of relief about that. But I'm just showing you. New Zealand has had some programs in since 1986. Gulf of St. Lawrence has had a deep water prawn fishery in since 1991. The Alaskan halibut fishery, which I am going to highlight just in a moment, started in 1995, and then the red snapper fishery here in the Gulf went into an IFTQ program in 2007. In looking at Alaskan halibut, it's kind of the poster child in many respects for IFQ or ITQ fisheries. Basically, it went from a season length that in the Gulf of Alaska, which harvested somewhere over 50% of the halibut in that region, particular location, went from a three-day fishing season to a 245-day fishing season after you went into an IFQ program. So it really extended that season out, where before they were truly in one of those race-to-fish situations. When you look at product price, product price increased to the point basically 56 cents per pound, averaging that out over vessels and basically putting it in real dollars, discounting the inflation that might have built in through the years, and any change in poundage that occurred, it's actually $18,000 more per vessel that is fishing in that fishery today as compared to what it was before the IFQ went into place. Product quality, you can only imagine. If you have a three-day fishing season, the race for fish, you're not taking care of your product, you're basically just trying to get it aboard and get it to the dock as fast as you can. Nowadays, anecdotally, they talk a whole lot about now almost all the halibut is a fresh product halibut. It basically goes to the dock, gets flown out of Alaska, and ends up on a restaurant or table very quickly after that. Catch per unit effort really hasn't changed in this fishery through time. One of the key, we talked about the ecological goals, the over-harvest frequency. Before IFQs, you had a 64% of the years you went over the total allowable catch or the target catch. After the IFQ, 0%. That's fish in the bank. That's fish in the bank for ecology reasons. That's fish in the bank for those fishermen later on. Lost gear mortality, again, fish in the bank. Basically, this was mortality of halibut and other things that might be caught in this gear. 554 metric tons, it's reduced to 125 metric tons. I can't give you all of those kinds of specifics for red snapper, but I can give you a couple things. In 2000, the season for red snapper was diminished to 66 days, and we were into this a spring season, a fall season. Spring season had two-thirds of the quota. Fall season had one-third of the quota. We would open for 10 days and close, and we would do that till the spring season quota was met, and then there was a little bit allocated in the fall, and we would do the same thing. Season ran for 66 days. Well, we got smarter. We added trip limits to extend that season out, 2,000-pound trip limits, Class A and Class B licenses, and 200-pound trip limits, and we were able to extend that season to 130 days. Well, today, after the first year of the program, there was about roughly the first, January had 3% of the landings, and all the other months had 6 to 7% on average. so it averaged out nicely. We've had landings of red snapper 12 months of the year in this last thing. Price per pound on red snapper went up by 25%, went from $290 to $360. When we talk about some of the key concepts, obviously what you're doing here is you're managing the output of the fishery. We're no longer managing the inputs, gear, capital, and so forth. We're managing the output. We're managing the total allowable catch. When you express that, then basically the share that you will be trying to allocate, whether it's to a community or an individual, that's when we talk about it being an IFQ, and it's expressed as some proportion of the tack. It's the privilege to harvest some proportion of the tack, whatever that tack may be set at. Obviously, one of the hardest things to do and one of the things you must consider in putting in one of these systems is being able to set the total allowable catch, being able to set it in a timely manner, being able to predict it with enough precision so that you're not leaving a lot of the fish on the table every year, or else you'd have to set very conservative goals. And obviously, if you have a fishery that's been being fished, that may be difficult to build consensus around. And then on top of that, you may have to consider the life cycle and seasonality of some of these fisheries, especially if you're dealing with a multi-species fishery. For instance, if you were dealing with the inshore shrimp fishery, where you have a brown shrimp fishery in the spring, and in the fall you would have a white shrimp fishery. If you're dealing with the red grouper fishery in the Gulf, the grouper fishery in the Gulf, you might be catching several different species of grouper throughout the year, and you have to deal with those issues of how you deal with those multi-species interactions. The big questions, just like they were in limited entry, is who gets to participate? Who gets the ticket in? Because we've already gone through limited entry here in Texas and moratoriums on our key fisheries. That may not be as big a question. So then what we would have to deal with is actually who gets what sort of catch rights and how we would set those. Now, we do have trip tickets in place in the last year, which would give us some historical records of those. But if you were going to go back any longer period of time, there would be issues surrounding that, how far back you could go and have adequate catch records. Another option is to divide it up equally amongst all the participants and then let the transferability, let the market work it out. That would be another option. When we talk about putting in IFQs or the concepts of IFQs, and many people want to talk about these issues as achieving that greater economic efficiency. And certainly, we believe those systems will do that. The systems can be put in place complementary to all the current regulations you have, or you can actually look at options to basically remove some of the regulations you've put in place that decrease efficiency. Now, you may have some of those that are in place that you would not want to remove. And I'll give a for instance. I'm not saying it's one we wouldn't want to remove, but we may never want to remove nursery areas from the shrimp fishery if we were to use an IFQ. I say if we were, because we certainly aren't down that road, but if we were to use, you may not want to give away that option. That may be too important, too critical to you. But another option that we could look at, and using that same example, might be an earlier start time in the morning, possibly. Now, all that is depending on the ability to monitor and enforce, and so we might be looking at additional enforcement tools. We might look at vessel monitoring systems, which is basically a transponder on the boat that tells you when that boat leaves the dock. And so that might be a tool that would help you monitor some of those regulatory relief items you could consider. In addition to that monitoring aspect, obviously with our trip ticket system, it's in place. It would give us the ability to monitor quotas, but it's probably not quite as timely as we would need it. We would probably have to look at some efficiency gains we can make. I think they're really doable in that respect, but it's just from a reporting perspective, we don't have all our dealers on a daily or a weekly reporting schedule right now. They're on a monthly reporting schedule. And those are things we could look at internally if we were to ever look at one of these programs. Obviously, what we're trying to do here is get the incentives right. I think that used to be Chairman Fitzsimmons' favorite discussion point, and using that in the managed land deer permits programs, many of the managed land program. You know, these systems in an open access or in a closed access fishery terms get the incentives right. They basically give that long-term horizon to that individual so that they can really plan for their futures and start to think about the future of the fishery long term. Obviously, long run, we put economic efficiencies back in the system, and we allow people to trade shares back and forth so that if you're a bigger operator and you want to fish more shares, you can go obtain them. You basically buy them in the open market. When we talk about some of the reasons why we see price increases, and profit increases has to do with this individual flexibility. You're able to go harvest the fish when you want to go harvest them at the price and time that you think is the best price you can receive. So it allows you to create that flexibility in your own business horizon or planning horizon within that context. Now, obviously, the bottom line goal to the people who would enter into such a program is the increased what we call rents in the fishery, which is excess profits, but it's basically the profits in the fishery. And in some of these fisheries, when they put these in, they go ahead and build the incentives in that as the rents or profits increase to a certain level, a portion of that is paid back to the state or to the country, in the case of New Zealand, to help fund any additional monitoring programs you may have to do or any additional enforcement you may have to do and so forth. With that concludes my presentation. It was a very brief presentation. Certainly, there's a lot of things and conferences that have been held about this, but I'd certainly like to answer any questions that I could at this time.
Robin, thanks. And in addition to the examples that you cited, what are there other agencies or Gulf agencies that are using it, or ITQs or Florida?
Within the context of the Gulf, the Red Snapper is the only one that I know of. There's in the Gulf Council now, we're working on a grouper IFQ. It's really mostly dealing with, well, it's hopefully it's going to be a multi-species complex. We're not far enough along to know that yet. There's also a similar program with quota shares regarding traps, crab traps in Florida, and it's kind of ran similarly to our limit. It's kind of a hybrid between a limited entry system and a quota system.
And what allocation methodology are they using?
They used some sort of historical number of traps that those fishermen had in previous times.
It's trapped.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Any questions? Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's interesting. Thanks, Ron. All right. Item number four, proposed offshore aquaculture rules.
Sometimes it can be pretty hysterical, but
sometimes not.
I thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. For the record, I'm Dr. Larry McKean, Director of Coastal Fisheries. Just to kind of introduce this topic, I think one of the things, you know, we normally come before you talking mostly about recreational fishing and sport fishing. That's the biggest issue here. But what you're going to get in the next today and tomorrow is a pretty good look at how we are trying to deal with commercial fisheries and how we're doing it going forward on it. So I think that's a good perspective, a good opportunity to do so. And that's what I'm going to talk about now is asking permission to publish for public comments some rule changes in our offshore aquaculture program. Mm-hmm. This commission adopted rules for offshore aquaculture back in November of 2006, and we use a model, and it seems to work for these types of situations where you have interest, perhaps conflict, or various divergent views on how you manage these types of things, is how do you make progress. And what we have done, for example, in managing shrimp aquaculture and shrimp disease and those types of things is to basically come up with the best approach we can and put something on the table and put it there as here's what we're going to do, but also have the flexibility on both sides of that issue to say, look, if we can come up with something better, we'll move and we'll take action to do so, but we need to start from someplace and we need to have some incentive to move, and that's what we've done here. When we put the rules into place back in 2006, we really had very few comments on those rules as to what would work or not. And I would tell you that in this case, Texas is leading the country pretty much in addressing this issue. And we try to be proactive in all these issues to put something out so that it can provide guidance to those folks that are wanting to move forward with the idea, so they'll have a good perspective of what they want to do, with the understanding that we know that they can be improved and probably will be in the future. And that's what we're talking about here. We finally have an applicant that's interested in perhaps pursuing this. They came in and looked at our rules, and at this time it has some concerns about them. We've been in discussions with them, very cooperative discussions, and basically our approach with them is that we have certain issues of which we're not going to be flexible on, and those are conservation issues, and primarily in this case dealing with protecting the genetic integrity of our native stocks, disease issues, and those types of things. We've had quite a bit of experience with that in dealing with shrimp, and so we put those rules into place, and so they understand that, and they're going to work with them. But on the other hand, there are some operational and procedural type rules that that could make their life easier as far as getting finance and meeting our requirements. And so we've been talking with them about that. And I'm just going to give you a quick run through of some of those that are the main ones that we would propose to go out for public comment to consider. For example, our original regulations require the permit to be issued to an individual. That's what we've done on shrimp farm, for example. It worked fine. But in this case, this is a corporation, and they it would help them. They feel better if it was they could also have these permits issued to corporations and other Texas-approved business models, and that's fine with us, looking at legal and otherwise. And our goal is to make sure we have someone that if we've got a problem, we can go to that person and get it dealt with, not just a corporation, so we would address that. One of our requirements in the initial rules was that we would not issue our permit until all of the permits had been issued and the facility had been constructed. Again, it was our shrimp model, had worked there well. But there's some concerns that, and understandably, that if you're trying to get finances in the millions of dollars, those entities that might loan you that money want to make sure that you have those permits, you can actually proceed. And so we worked out a proposed process that would allow them to put everything, to get those permits in place before construction. With the understanding if they don't follow those permits, we're going to be right on them, but that's fine. It seems to be no problem. Our original proposals, our original regulations required that if there was some need to remove infrastructure, for example, the company was closing business or something like that, they had to remove that within 10 days. The groups have come back and said, well, 10 days is a short period of time when you're working offshore with the potential weather conditions and so forth. We don't have a problem with that, so we've reached an agreement that, 60 days seems to be a reasonable approach, and so that's what we would propose for consideration. We've not had an appeals process, for example, in a situation where we would, say, deny a permit or revoke a permit if some problem is going along. We have not had that in place. And they certainly have some concern about that. They want to be able to present their side of arguments in case they disagree with why we took those actions. Certainly, we have models in the agency and other regulations in which we do that. So we're going to put that into place to give them an appeals process. There was some simple updates of languages, things, new terms have come about that different agencies have used that we're going to update to make sure they now match new rules. That's what this GLO language is about. They've made some changes in their regulations. We want to match those to make it work better. In our original regulations, we defined a potential disease condition as if they had 5% of mortality within a single cage. They've come back and made a point that, when you're handling fish on this scale, you can have 5% mortality just from handling impacts, just from the pure physical contact with them. And we understand that our concern about disease remains, and so our approach would be fine. You don't have to remove those fish. You don't have to call them disease, but you will have to get a sample of that tissue or the fish into an approved veterinarian facility within the 48 hours to tell us for sure that it's a physical rather than a disease issue. And that seems to be an acceptable way to operate, and we do some things like that with shrimp as well. We want to have some options. At one point, our only option, if there was a problem, is they would have to remove their fish resources. There are situations where you can treat and work with issues in other ways, and so we want to give us a little flexibility there to work with them in that situation. So we would add to our regulations the fact that we would have other options to look at as well, and that's what this would do. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that's give you a flavor of the types of things that we're recommending to go out for public comment, and so we'll have everyone make comment on that and see what comes out, come back to you in May for your consideration.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you. If there are no further questions or discussion, I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Item 5, commercial non-game species regulations. Permission to publish. Dr. Matt Wagner.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and Commission. My name is Matt Wagner. I'm Program Director for Wildlife Diversity. We're coming to you today with permission to publish and propose rules and changes to our non-game permit program. Some of you will recall in April of 2007, we amended our current regulations to create a whitelist of non-game species legal for commercial collection. At that time, existing collections of non-game not on the whitelist were grandfathered temporarily. The Commission instructed staff at that time to look into procedures for folks to keep those collections with proper documentation. And based on our current information, most individuals that we know of keep box turtles for personal use as well as the sale of the offspring. Box turtles are on the prohibited list now. They are not legal for commercial collection out of the wild. So we want to find a way to allow people to retain those current collections with proper documentation. We know of there's probably at least 1,000 individuals that have box turtle collections. What we're proposing is a pit tagging system to tag all adult box turtles in captivity. A pit is a passive integrative transponder. These are microchips about the size of a grain of rice with a unique number that is activated by a handheld scanner. These are actually implanted into the body cavity or just below the skin of various animals. And today people are actually pit tagging their pets or cats and dogs. But they're typically used in research. And I have some samples of pits for you if you'd like to look at them. What this would do would be to create a system to distinguish captive box turtles from wild populations. The instruction for tagging would be provided by Parks and Wildlife in partnership with various conservation organizations that we have relationships with, various zoos, herpetological societies around the state.
That's Matt, sorry to jump in.
Go ahead.
That's veterinarians.
Veterinarians associated mostly with zoos. We also have a user group formed that there is at least one veterinarian on that user group that's working with us. In addition to the pit tagging proposal, what we want to do is take care of some housekeeping. We want to make corrections to the list of non-game species that are prohibited for commercial use. We want to remove three species, the corn snake, the house mouse, the rough-footed or Chihuahuan mud turtle. These animals are either non-native, so we don't get engaged in regulating non-native species. The mud turtle is actually a protected species under our threatened species list. So that would be a housekeeping matter that we would try to do at the same time. We're seeking your permission to publish in the Texas Register, and I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Questions?
What's the source of the 1,000 collector number?
That's an estimate based on the user group that we're working with. We've actually had about 20 or 30 individuals call us and let us know that they have back box turtles, how many they have, what they're doing. They're either possessing them for their own use or they're breeding them and selling them. But in talking to the various herpetological groups, there are many, many more people that have these animals we don't know about. We intend to send out press releases, get in touch with all the people that are permitted to have non-game, and make sure we get the word out. We would have to give them a period of time to get this work done, possibly a year.
Matt, did you bring a sample pit tag? Would you just show the commission that and look how that works?
Let me pass this around. There's actually a 1,000 or 100 of those pit tags in that vial. Our herpetologist, Dr. Andy Price, is with us as well today. He's been doing some of this work with Houston Toad. We actually have a supply of pit tags on hand. They're around $3 or $4 a piece. We would think about providing them at cost, at our cost, to the people that would actually be doing the work.
You could be talking about a whole lot of turtles.
Yeah.
Possibly. Now, Ohio and Indiana both are doing this, and Ohio, Andy tells me, there may be several thousand box turtles that have been pit tagged so far.
Other questions?
Thanks. Yes. I'm confused about the corn snake. You say remove it from the list that may not be used in commercial activity. So you're suggesting that people who breed corn snakes and sell them can do it without any prohibition or restriction?
In Texas, that is the case since it is not native to our state.
So why would that snake be any different from a cobra or any other non-native snake?
Well, We have rules now in place for exotic snakes, as a matter of fact, but you know, our rules specify that non-game are indigenous to the state of Texas. So we do not have the authority to regulate non-indigenous species.
But I thought there were regulations on cobras and pythons.
The legislature actually gave us that authority.
Oh, it's by statute.
Yes, sir.
By specie.
There are five constrictors that are named in that rule, along with the non-native venomous snakes. So it specifies which snakes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Matt.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Item number 6, amendments to the harmful or potentially harmful exotic fish, shellfish, or aquatic plants rules. Phil.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, I'm Phil DeRosa, the Director of Inland Fisheries. At the last commission meeting, we got permission from the commission to publish some proposed amendments to the potentially for the harmful or potentially harmful exotic fish, shellfish, and aquatic plant rules. Those amendments were to prohibit the possession, sale, and culture of live silver and black carp. That was recommended to put us in line with the federal rules. The feds just prohibited all those on those two species. Also included was to prohibit the possession, sale, and culture of all live Southern Hemisphere crayfish. The one we're really dealing with was the red claw crayfish. It was the only one that was allowed to be possessed and grown by permit from this agency. And last, made an amendment to prohibit the taking of triploid grass carp from public waters where stocking was permitted by this agency. Those animals are very expensive, and if we issue a permit and have a management plan with someone to help control aquatic vegetation, we feel like that they ought to have the right to keep those fish in that lake. We took these rules for public comments, and we got 19 in favor of the proposed amendments and 3 opposed. Now, I know the commission received some information from a fish farm, the Cotulla Fish Hatchery near Cotulla, Texas, who opposed it. He is, at the current time, culturing some red claw crayfish. Our understanding is it's not a profitable business, but he wanted to be able to continue to do that. We reviewed the information that he sent us. I sent this information to the staff, and I'd like to introduce Dr. Dan Daugherty. He's with the staff at the Heart of the Hills, and he did the evaluation of this information. He's the gentleman that prepared the risk assessment that I provided for you at the last meeting. And our findings are, we believe that the red claw crayfish can escape from aquaculture facilities. If it escapes, it will survive and establish feral populations in Texas. And we believe that it can negatively affect endemic Texas crayfishes. Our primary concern is with 13 species, endemic species of crayfish that occur only in Texas in small geographical areas, including the Nueces crayfish, is known from a single location near Jordanton within the Nueces River watershed. So because of those findings, the staff is going to make a recommendation tomorrow that the commission approve this motion, which will prohibit, which will approve all those prohibitions we proposed.
Thanks. No questions?
Yes. And what happens to the crayfish that is on this farm?
He's going to have to, we're going to work with him to help him destroy those, right.
Okay. Thanks, Bill. All right. Place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Committee item number 7, 2008-2009 Statewide Hunting and Fishing Proclamation. Inland Fisheries up. Ken, thanks.
Thank you, Commissioners. My name is Ken Krasowski with the Inland Fisheries Division, and today we're going to go over our proposed fishing regulations and relate the public input that we've collected on those. First one was here on Lady Bird Lake. So currently, there's no regulation for common carp on their reservoir. Our proposal was to put a limit to the number of carp you could harvest over 33 inches to one per day. So that means all carp below 33 inches could be harvested unlimited, and that only be one over could be harvested. We want to protect some of those carp from potential harvest, promote bank angling in that area and also carp angling. We don't see that there'll be any major increase in the abundance of carp. Some of the comments, we did receive a number of comments on this, and I might note that almost all the comments that will be relating for all our proposals came in over our website. There's the majority of the comments for this particular one were in favor. Next, we had a proposal on community fishing lakes. Those are our smaller reservoirs within city limits and within state parks. Our change there would be to limit the number of poles anglers could use in those reservoirs to only two. We wouldn't put that regulation on state park lakes at this time. Our goal there was to alleviate some of the crowding concerns that have been raised by our staff, especially when we're stocking catfish or trout in those areas where people can monopolize limited access areas. And this would help give more people an opportunity to catch those fish that we're stocking in there. Most of the comments were in favor of that one. And Lake Nacogdoches, we have a proposal concerning largemouth bass. Currently, we have a 14 to 21 slot limit there. Our proposed change would be a 16-inch maximum length limit and maintaining that 5-fish bag. And I might note here that in your agenda, the register item notes this as a minimum length limit. That was incorrect, and we'll have to change that for the final one to the maximum length limit. And this would, although we would prohibit anglers from harvesting bass over 16 inches, this would allow anglers to temporarily retain one of those fish, and they could contact us if they had a scale on board, and we would accept that into the share lunker program if it was over 13 inches. Most of the comments were in favor of that particular proposal. Next, we have on a couple of state park lakes, Purtis Creek and Lake Raven. We have a catch and release regulation on those two reservoirs, but we had a similar exception there that you could retain a fish of a bass of a certain size and weigh it at a lakeside weigh station. We've had some problems with those lakeside weigh stations, and we're going to implement a change similar to what we have on Nacogdoches, maintain that 24-inch size limit, and allow anglers to temporarily retain them and donate them to the Share Lunker program, and we would eliminate references to the lakeside weigh station. Those are the comments received on that particular proposal. Our next set, a change on Lake Texoma. Our current regulation on that reservoir was a 14-inch minimum, 5-fish bag. Our proposal was to remove that minimum length limit and retain the 5-fish bag, and that would be the same as our statewide regulation. So this was an exception up there to our statewide bag, and that was to get our regulations the same as we have on the Oklahoma side. Oklahoma is proposing a similar change, removing the size limit, so we're proposing that so we can keep the regulations the same on both sides of the reservoir and also have our limit there the same as our statewide limit. Those are some of the comments we received on that. We have some regulations on Red Drum. We have a handful of reservoirs in freshwater that we stock with Red Drum, and there are some particular requirements that need to be met for those reservoirs. One of them is to have a heated water source from a power plant. We had two reservoirs that we had been stocking, Lake Masworthy and Colorado City. There's been some changes to the operation of the power plants there. We had some special regulations on with the stocking of the Red Drum. Because the power plants have changed, we will no longer have those warm water inputs. We're going to discontinue stocking in those reservoirs, and we're proposing to have those special regulations revert back to the statewide limits, which are actually the limits that we have on that most people are familiar with on the coast. Most of the comments were in favor of that particular regulation. Next, I'd like to have Phil go over our proposal for
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, again, I'm Phil DeRosa, the Director of Inland Fisheries. The last proposal we had that went to the register and for public comment was to extend the bull fishing for catfish season until August 31st of 2001, which would have added three additional years to this proposal, for this regulation. The reason for submitting this proposal was to allow for more public input, to allow the commission to get more public input on this issue. And what it did, what it does as it was published, was gives the commission three different options that they can look at when considering this regulation. The first option they have is to don't approve the extension. If we don't approve this extension, bull fishing regulation would expire on August 31st of this year. The second option the commission has, of course, is to approve the three-year extension and allow this activity to take place for three more years. Sorry. Let me catch up here. And the third option the commission has is to make the rule permanent. We can remove the expiration date and just make bull fishing for catfish a permanent rule in the state. Now, since we have some new commissioners here, I'd like to briefly go over a little historical perspective of how we got here. In 2005, the Texas Bull Fishing Association petitioned the commission for change, asking that this that they be allowed to harvest catfish by bull fishing. Proposal to allow this was presented at our public hearings in 2006. At that time, the staff recommended against the proposal. The staff's reasoning, first of all, I want to say we have no indication that this would have been or would be, at this point in time, a resource issue because it's such a small-scale activity. But we recommended against it for several reasons. First, catfish are the second most popular game fish in fresh water. We felt like this would have been devaluing one of our most popular sport fish. The second, this would be a break with a long-standing management approach of selective harvest that we practice both in freshwater and saltwater, because that approach is dependent on catch and release, which you can't do with bow fishing. And second and thirdly, would set a precedent. Catfish would become the only game fish allowed in the state to be taken by bow fishing. Now, the commission directed the staff to go ahead and take an experimental look at this regulation, and they allowed the taking of catfish for 2 1-year periods beginning September of 2006. They directed the staff to focus on looking at the increase in opportunity, any increase in activity, and they asked us to monitor this activity. The results of our monitoring, since there's no special permits required for bull fishing for any fish, we went to the game wardens, and we'd like to thank Colonel Flores and his staff for helping us go out and look at this activity and see what was actually going on. The game wardens, we looked at about 4,600 monthly logs that the game wardens keep as they go out on the lake and encounter people doing certain activities on the lake. Looking at those logs, in a 14-month period, they encountered 1,792 bow anglers. That's not separate bow anglers. That's statewide, and that may be the same people they saw numerous times. And what we found out is that this is mostly a spring and summer activity, and we observed no change in activity by the bull fishermen from prior to the passage of this rule to this past summer. And here's the chart showing kind of the activity. What you have to look at is the June 06, the beginning of the chart, the first three bars there. This was actually the year before the summer before the regulation went into effect. And you compare that to the other comparable data we have, which is June, July, and August of 07, and we have no indication there that we've had an increase in activity.
Phil, sorry, is this, sorry to interrupt you, but is this related to any type of bow fishing?
Or
is
yes,
this,
sir.
Okay.
This is, I mean, always pre-reg.
Right. Pre-reg.
Yeah, and what we found is most of the bow fishermen were going after catfish after the rule was changed, which is what we expected. Okay, the public comments. You can see it's about 50-50. We had a split in the public comments. We took all of our recommendations to our Freshwater Fishery Advisory Board. They met on March the 4th, and the members present voted unanimously to support all the proposals for inland fisheries, except the extension of allowing the use of bow fishing equipment for taking catfish. And the board, I must say, the board took a similar stance against this practice when first proposed in 2006.
Phil, can I ask you, you've got for and against. What were they voting for or against? Like, you showed three options to us.
Four was extending it.
Extending it for 3 years?
Right.
That's why, okay. But that was the only option presented to the public.
Right, that was the only option presented to the public at the time.
And the opposition by the Freshwater Fishery Advisory Board, can you just brief us on the...
I think the commission all received the letter, and I can read this for you if you want me to.
It's basically... The denigration of the fish as a game fish, right?
Right, primarily. And it says it's just against the philosophy of catch and release. Yes.
I did a little checking on this and looked into the history or practice of bow fishing. What I could tell, Native American Indians bow fished for trout and a number of other game fish. I mean, was that taken into account when people had a problem with this on denigrating the catfish as a game fish?
We haven't heard anything from any Native Americans. I mean, we haven't heard any comments from that group.
What about on catch and release? I don't profess to be a skilled catfisherman, but when I've done it, most of the time they swallow the treble hook, so I don't know how there's much catch and release because they're not really, my experience is not a lip biter. Is that...
Do you disagree
with that?
I don't think that's a general rule. I mean, I don't think they're any worse than any of the other game fish in terms of their ability to survive being caught. I haven't seen any data to make me believe that they're any worse than a bass. I mean, you know, bass get deep hooked pretty frequently too, and almost anything that's caught with a hook.
Anything that's gut hooked though, it has a high mortality rate. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
And that's what I'm saying. I think that most catfish are caught, at least in my practice. Maybe I'm slow on the draw, but
I haven't seen anything to indicate that it would be any worse than any other game fish.
Phil, how many people are out doing this? I mean, is there any way to get our hands around the community of people who are bow fishing for catfish?
I would say, you know, we have no way of knowing because there's no special tag or anything required of bow fishing. I would look at the number of people here who voted for it. I would say it's probably somewhere there in 400, maybe, at the most. Again, we looked at the number of people that belong to the bow fishing organization, and it's anywhere from 150 to 250, maybe, at the most that we know of.
Commissioner Falcon?
Yeah. What about citations on the logs?
None that we know of.
No.
If I can talk to several game wardens about this, and this is not an actual scenario, but if they pull up to a bow fisherman at night, he's running big lights, what's the legal inch limit on a
12 inch?
12 inches. And if he pulls up there and there's a 10-inch and 11-inch floating belly up in the water, because you know one stick and he's dead. You're talking about deep hook. Well, that arrow is deep hook too. You all know anything about these fish floating? No, they were here when we got here. I gave more. Go on. What can I say? Possible management law enforcement issue. Unless they're sitting out there with night vision goggles and they're seeing them, they see him throw the fish back, which is going to be highly, highly, highly involved. Law enforcement nightmare.
Any other questions or discussion? Okay, thank you. And now, Dr. Berger.
afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members. For the record, I'm Mike Berger, Director of the Wildlife Division, and we're here this afternoon to discuss the proposed changes to the wildlife statewide regulations. First is with regard to mule deer, and in the panhandle, you'll note that we have three different seasons, two in the panhandle, one is for 16 days, and one is for 9 days. Our proposal that we would propose adding Sherman and Hansford counties, the two counties in the very north of the panhandle, and Gaines, Martin, and the eastern half of Andrews County to the southwest panhandle season. These counties, we believe, have mule deer populations sufficient to allow the harvest of a few buck mule deer, and such buck-only harvest would not have any effect on the overall population of deer in those counties, and it would result in increased hunter opportunity. Regarding comments, some folks expressed some concerns about the possibility of poaching, trespassing, or taking too many bucks, but overall the comments were extremely supportive of those proposals. Under Parks and Wildlife Service regulations, proof of sex, which generally means the head, must accompany a harvested deer until it reaches its final destination or has been finally processed, unless the hunter has obtained a signed statement from the landowner or from a taxidermist. And to simplify the proof of sex requirements for deer, we propose the department permits listed here would function as proof of sex in lieu of the head or other signed statements. I think these changes would simplify hunters transporting harvested deer to their final destination, and these permits do have on them a place to indicate the sex of the animal harvested. And again, although a few comments expressed concerns about making it too easy for crooks or that hunters might be untrustworthy in doing this, the great majority again supported this proposal. Currently, we have a requirement for a minimum 40-pound peak draw weight for archery hunting of turkeys and all game animals other than squirrels. 20 or so states still have this kind of requirement, but many others have shifted to a 30 or a 35-pound requirement as the evolution of archery equipment has progressed and bows become more efficient at lower weights. In fact, 11 other states have no draw weight requirement whatsoever. And we believe that a reduction in the minimum draw weight requirement would increase the opportunity for younger hunters or folks of smaller stature to allow them to bow hunt when they would have difficulty pulling a 40-pound draw weight bow. Most commenters supported eliminating the minimum draw weight. However, some did express concerns about the possibility of increasing wounding loss, and some recommended lowering the draw weight to 30 pounds instead of removing it altogether, and others wanted to require mandatory archery education. Again, the support for this was about 5-3 in favor, and our recommendation is to eliminate the minimum peak draw weight and encourage all bow hunters to practice and become very familiar with the capabilities of their equipment that they use regardless of its draw weight. With regard to quail, under the current rule, the quail season, which is a statewide season, opens on the Saturday closest to October 28 and closes on the last Sunday in February. The proposal was to extend the closing of quail season until the last day of February to coincide with the close of deer season on managed land permit level 1 and 2 properties. This proposal was published in the Texas Register, and it generated a great deal of comment and discussion, some of it quite strong, and some of the discussion also appearing in the print media. Although the comments generally supported the proposed extension, some commenters suggested shortening the season, others said reduce the daily bag limit, move the MLD closing back to the end of the quail season. And I really believe that most of the commenters and writers agreed that the few days that the proposal would extend the season agreed that it was of little consequence, but it sent a wrong message regarding the status of quail, not only in Texas, but throughout its range.
So hearing this comment and concern, the staff recommends that the commission not adopt this extension of quail season and allow the Upland Game Bird Advisory Council to an opportunity to discuss and consider this issue at its upcoming meeting in April so that it can return with a recommendation if needed during the next regulatory cycle next year.
Can you say that again, Mike? Sorry, I lost it in the
Okay. Our recommendation and based of all the comment that we've heard and the variety of comment for solutions is that the commission not adopt the regulation as published and allow the Upland Game Bird Council an opportunity to review all the comment and the recommendations, and if they feel necessary, to come back with a proposal in the next regulatory cycle next year. With regard to the panhandle pheasant season, this map shows where we have the panhandle counties that currently have an open season for pheasants. In six of these counties, the northwest six most counties, Dallam, Hartley, Moore, Oldham, Potter, and Sherman, the seasons for white-tailed deer and mule deer run from the Saturday before Thanksgiving for 16 days, meaning that the close of deer season and the opening of pheasant season coincide and overlap on one single weekend. The proposal would have delayed the opening of pheasant season until the second Saturday in December and had the option to extend the season length to 37 days, which would carry it through the Christmas New Year period. Again, this proposal was supported by a majority of commenters, but it generated highly variable, more variable than quail, comments to keep the season the same as current, to open it later as we proposed, to open it a week earlier or even 2 weeks earlier. Some supported 7 days, some said 30 days was enough. Some hunters as well as guides expressed concern that hunting plans and reservations for the coming season had already been made for 2008 and a change would represent a hardship. For these reasons that we believe the commission again should not adopt this proposal at this time and to give the Upland Game Bird Council an opportunity to review all these comments and consider the issue at its upcoming meetings and come back in the next cycle with a recommendation if necessary.
So the bird people are kind of like the deer people, aren't they?
They
care passionately.
They care passionately.
I'm glad.
The quail and pheasant hunters are passionate.
That's
yes,
right.
Yes, sir.
It's wonderful, and that's why we have these advisory committees. And,
yes, sir.
And allows people to give input, and then we can make more whatever the right decision is.
That's correct.
Okay, good.
And I think this is the opportunity to put a little more focus and discussion.
Absolutely.
All right. Based on staff recommendation, I suggest that we authorize staff to amend the proclamation to remove the proposed extension of the quail season and the extension of the or the change in calendar dates of the pheasant season. Any discussion on that or comment? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Place this item. Well, let's go. We've got Dr. McKinney still. Sorry.
You want to skip us that time?
No,
we'll be.
I have to grab a cup of coffee.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, for the record, Dr. Larry McKinney, Director of Coastal Fisheries, and Robin Rikers, Director of Science and Policy. We're going to tag team on this presentation, I think, and Robin is going to start dealing with coastal fisheries issues, or the issue.
Of course, we're dealing with the statewide hunting and fishing proclamation proposals for 2008-2009. To remind everyone, the Coastal Fisheries statewide proposal is to set a total allowable catch for the Texas Territorial Sea using an approximate average of landings from 2002 to 2006. We rounded that up a little bit, and that would establish the TAC at 31,500,000 pounds. In reviewing many of the public comments, I've chosen these five specific items to try to highlight here to you today. You've seen a lot of those comments as well, but we'll discuss the item and the claim about science in the public comments. We'll discuss Gulf-wide management. We'll discuss limited entry, observers, and tracking of the quota. Just briefly, again, reminding you, basically, we propose this as a proactive, not a reactive, precautionary ecosystem-based approach to management of this fishery. We discussed last time
the magnitude of the bycatch in both numbers and pounds. We discussed the number of spills and the interaction and how that occurs as they're prosecuting the fishery out in the near shore Gulf area. When we go on to the science, though, beyond the register and the proposal as we've talked about it today, we want to talk to you just a little bit about some of the things that was in the science that we didn't present to you, maybe and we're remiss in that respect, but also in view of how some other folks are viewing the current situation in regards to things like this. Enclosed in the packet that you've received is a letter from 91 marine scientists requesting the National Marine Fisheries Service to recommend basically following four general principles. And these recommendations to the National Marine Service come on the heels of findings from the National Research Council's Committee on Ecosystem Effects of Fishing Phase 2 that basically it's entitled Dynamic Changes in Marine Ecosystems, Fishing, Food Webs, and Future Options. The two first recommendations there basically just talk about the critical role that forage fish play and the uncertainty in measuring those forage fish. But the last two are the ones that are of key importance here in this discussion, and that MSY is not really an appropriate basis for setting catch levels. In fact, the last item goes on to say that forage fish require more conservative standards than setting an MSY approach, and it should be accounted for when you're setting those target levels in regards to
MSY.
That's right, because MSY is maximum sustained
yield. I'm sorry.
Yes,
so make sure everybody understands
that. Right, I want to follow through.
In addition, the stock assessment that we referred to last time that basically did say that we're not overfished or undergoing overfishing in this fishery at this time also went on to point out several very important things. It went on to say that the stock is below the ideal level. It went on to say that the hypoxic zone may be increasing the susceptibility of harvest for menhaden as we're prosecuting that fishery today. It talks about recent rises in fishing mortality. Basically, then it goes on to conclude that rise in fishing mortality and the decrease in landings is consistent with the decrease in the overall abundance in the fishery at this time. So those are some key other science points that we thought, given the comments that we had seen, we needed to bring out to you today.
In the Gulf primarily, Robin? Help me.
Okay, well, this would be in the Gulf, because these are based on stock assessment that comes from the landings associated with the overall Gulf fishery. And of course, again, we make up just a small percentage share of that overall
right.
Gulf fishery. We make up about 3%. Of that fishery, Louisiana makes up about 95%, and then the other two states, Mississippi and Alabama, get the rest.
And the point that Robin's making is that this is from the stock assessment by a scientist named Vaughn, paper
right.
by Vaughn, which I don't know if we've included in our package. But it's often cited as saying that that fishery is in good shape. It's and that type of thing. But if you take that paper and read their conclusions, don't just take part of the
right.
of what they say. These are the issues, the cautions that they raise, and this is the kind of things we look at in fisheries. We look at them in other fisheries. Well, these are things that begin did raise concern in our view of what we need to do future-wise for this type of fishery. That's what we're talking about.
With that, I'll go on to some of those other key issues, and the first one we'll talk about is a Gulf-wide total allowable catch. You may have seen in the comments, and you may hear some tomorrow, about that we really should be managing this fishery with a Gulf-wide total allowable catch. We really don't disagree with that. We think that would be a good way to manage this fishery, and we certainly will work with our partners in the other states, with industry and other folks, to look at managing this in a Gulf-wide basis. One of the key discussion points about managing this in a Gulf-wide basis is what are those appropriate catch targets? Going back to that question of, is it MSY? Is it a more conservative approach? How do we get that exact target, and how can we really come to grips with what that should be? Then even under this case, we're talking about a Gulf-wide total allowable catch, because this fishery is prosecuted a lot within state waters, there's still going to be a state allocation, similar to what we're asking you to do here, basically, because if you did manage for a Gulf-wide catch, assuming that we're managing, let's assume we're managing close to the target at this point in time, then you would be taking some sort of average of those past historical periods and setting a total allowable catch in Texas state waters, so that we, of course, could manage that catch within our waters, unless any of those states would be willing to have all the share of the catch come out of their waters in a particular given year. If you're going to manage it within all those states and you're going to have prosecution in all those states, you're still going to have some sort of share total
coming out of those particular states so that it can be managed on a, and enforced on a state-by-state basis to some degree. Another option you may hear is a discussion about limited entry. And we view limited entry as a complementary tool to the proposal that we have in the statewide hunting fishing proclamation today. The reason we view it as a complementary tool is certainly given the current level of harvest that we've seen on average in that 5 years, we've had on average 12 boats during that 5 years, and we've had catches from 9 to 65 million pounds. Tremendous range of catches for each one of those individual vessels. So we view it as a complementary tool. It will protect the historical participants. If we went and established a limited entry program, it would protect those historical participants who have been in the fishery in the past, much as we've done with many of our other commercial fisheries, and certainly we promote that as one of our management tools in the right situation.
I want to make a comment on that, too, and I think you'll hear that tomorrow, and I want to emphasize one of the points that Robin made. And it really goes back even to the discussion I was having earlier on the offshore aquaculture approach. And that is the tool that we have available to us today to manage this fishery and to address the concerns that we have is what's being proposed by staff. But in fact, under the new Magnuson-Stevens Act, at some time in the future, or perhaps at some point, the menhaden fishery will be managed in the same way as other fisheries will be. There will be an effort, we think, to manage this species go wide. That's a positive thing. We would support that and go forward with it. Same with limited entry. I think it offers some opportunities. And so what we see as taking the step, or if you were to adopt the step that we're saying, it really, I think it drives that process. I think it puts a position to say, look, this is what we have available, but if we can come up with something better, one that achieves those ends that we're concerned with, we'll go there, and we will work in that method and go forward with it. That's what I want to get the point across to folks. But this I would hope, would move that process more quickly than it might otherwise happen and still give us cover some of the concerns that we have at present.
The third bullet there, onboard observation, basically deals with the ideal of having an onboard observer upon either a set of randomly chosen vessels possibly or a census of the entire fleet, have them on every vessel. Certainly, we believe that depending on how you structured your program, it would provide a more accurate reading of the overall landings. It would have to be a verification on-site of an independent party to verify the landings records right at that point in time. It would aid in tracking a quota or a total allowable catch if you were to do that. Obviously in that case, it would probably be considered to be on every vessel. As far as bycatch characterization goes, it would also aid in that. Now, it may only be a random sample of trips if you were just trying to characterize your overall bycatch, both in magnitude and in what is there and how much of it is there. It would give us some additional, more current data in regards to bycatch. So, again, those are certainly things we would like to discuss and continue to discuss, look at opportunities to work with our partners, both industry and other partners, in looking at ways that we can fund some of that research. It might be that we do it Gulf-wide. It might be that we only do it here in Texas. But at this point, we don't believe it should be necessarily part of this rulemaking, but we would certainly like to continue that discussion and obtain better opportunity for that data collection down the road if we could.
And a comment on that, if you don't mind this time, Robin, is that we tried to either meet or talk in whatever way we could with interested parties on all sides, but there's some very, very strong views on both sides, and try to make sure we understand those concerns. And I think that tomorrow, if the folks testify, that I'm assuming will, that you will hear a strong desire, a strong wish for an observer type program from some of those groups. And as Robin said, we have not put that on the table as our staff recommendation at this time. And then talking with Ann Bride, our general counsel, to give you the heads up that if this was something that was of interest to the commission, it would be a significant change from staff recommendation, and we would have to take a look at reconsidering the entire proposal, pulling it back off, because it's just too much of a change to go forward with it at the time, because it's not in our original staff recommendation. But I just want to make sure we're aware of that.
Which change?
Oh, yeah, for now, our staff recommendation only looks at a total allowable catch. We have not talked about an observer program, and that would be, if that were something to be added, it would be a significant change from staff and require re-notice and public input at that time.
Senator, The number that you're recommending is the highest that's been caught previously. Is that correct? That 31 million pounds?
I think we'll get to that in just a second. But No, it's not.
Okay. Well, my question is, you're recommending a number in spite of the science basis chart that you showed up there that showed all of the decrease in the stock and susceptibility, fishing mortality. You're still recommending a higher... Well, maybe you'll answer that question.
Okay, I understand where you're going.
And quickly to answer, we're recommending the average of the last 5 years, and landings have been declining in this fishery. So this is kind of a capping or averaging of the most recent time period. So in some respects, well, I think maybe your question would be, why wouldn't we go further? At this point in time, I think we're just, establish the cap and continue to monitor this fishery closely. We do have, a good database we're looking at here. We do have good modeling. We would like to, have a chance to basically establish the cap and continue to work on some of these other issues, the accuracy of the landings, bycatch characterization, as well as we may be back here at another next year or the year after that, either indicating that we should reduce the cap or indicating that we might should raise the cap, depending on what we see in the stock assessment at that time.
And you think we can gather that data in a year?
Well, the data comes in a year. The question is what 1 year's worth of data would make in the overall trend picture in this fishery. And typically when we look at abundance trends here, we really do try to look at more than just 1 year, because one additional year, even if it's a little tick up, doesn't signal that it's in a lot better shape. And it also, if it's a little tick down, doesn't necessarily signal that it's in a lot worse shape. It's just... one more point in the trend line.
You also mentioned that Louisiana has 95% of the stock. And what are they? What is it that they do? Do they have any limits or?
No, not stock, the catch.
Yeah. Oh, the catch. I'm sorry.
Catch.
Okay, the
catch.
Of the total catch, they have 95% of it.
Yes. And can I add just to add to, because you mentioned Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. Is Florida not allowing fishing in the Gulf side?
That's correct. Florida has no... Well, yeah. Yeah, Florida does not allow purse seine in their waters. And Alabama, which we were trying to get that straight, it was an aerial-type closure, I think.
They still allow fishing on the western side, which I think we corrected on the record last time when we were scoping. Mm-hmm. The stock assessment had said they were totally closed in Alabama waters, but they weren't totally closed. There is a portion on the western side that's still open. With that, kind of the last question of the items that I wanted to hit was the total allowable catch tracking or how we would go about this. Currently, the fishery basically provides to National Marine Fisheries Service Captain Daily Fishing Reports. Those are provided every Friday during the fishing season. And basically what we would do is we would look to obtain those from National Marine Fisheries Service or from industry directly. We would be able to total those up based on last week catches and basically create a running total of what the percentage catch is to that point in the season. Upon looking at this, most of the week's worth of catches falls within a 10% of what a total allowable, if the total allowable catch is 31,500,000 pounds, it would fall within that kind of range. So we basically would start notifying the company of an impending closure at about 80%, 75 or 80%. That would give them a couple weeks' notice. Even if we're in the lag week and they have boats out fishing, you still got some buffer there. And then on top of that, we would even, and we're going to suggest that we create a rollover provision that allows a 10% rollover of both if you catch too much, you can roll that over into next year and it goes off of next year's quota. And if you don't catch up to the quota, you can roll that into next year's quota and it increases next year's quota by just that amount, up to 10%. Now, that rollover provision would only apply to 1 year. You couldn't stack quota for multiple years. It would just go over 1 year.
That's fair.
When you look at the public comments, of course, the numbers here and in your packet, we kind of tried to give you a flavor of the comments and some of the email comments and the totals and so forth. We basically had 2,788 people supporting the proposal. We had 278 people opposing the proposal as of yesterday afternoon, fairly late in the day. Of those, when you look at your web comments, you'll notice, I believe, that there's 60 in the web comments. that actually say disagree there. Out of those have been 39 of those who wrote something in their disagreement, and they wrote something basically wanting a stricter proposal or a total closure in Texas Territorial Sea. We've moved up them up into the support category. We assumed that they would support the proposal since they really wanted a more stricter rule than that. But that's your totals as far as public summary comments go at this point in time.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to provide a comment, and perhaps Commissioner Falcone would address the issue that you raised, and that is to talk very briefly about how we approach managing these types of issues and have. Our approach has been historically in coastal fisheries to take a look at these issues out ahead and try to be proactive on them. One of the reasons being that certainly gives us more options. All affected parties have more options to deal with it other than waiting until situations that we have seen on the East Coast where there have been fisheries collapses and whole industries have closed. And that's not where we want to go at all, and not where we have gone. And so when we looked at this particular issue and looked at the sort of warning signs of concerns that were raised, we wanted to look at some way to address those concerns in a way that did not harm the industry any more than possible. And so in doing that, looking at a total allowable catch based on some average over that period of time that basically said, that we would not increase the catch above this at this time, and would protect those fish above that number for the sport fishing industry and for supporting the ecosystem issues that are of concern. And in talking with the industry, they have assured us many times that they have no plans to expand, to bring more ships in, to expand their fishery at all, their capacity. So this seemed to be an approach that allowed them to proceed and continue under the business that they're doing now, but obviously make the point that expanding this industry, but until we have better assurances and better management tools, it would not be something that we'd want to do. This approach with Menhaden is entirely consistent with the approaches that we have taken with managing shrimp farms with offshore aquaculture. Back in the year 2000, when we put regulations into place for the shrimp industry as a whole, again, this is the same approach we used there. When you all adopted the rules to protect seagrass and Redfish Bay, again, this was a precautionary approach that we looked at. And last year, when we tackled a very difficult problem of spotted sea trout in Lower Laguna Madre, again, taking action at that time. And so that's the basis on which as we move forward. It's fortunate that in the last few weeks we've had some data that's come forward that really, I think, illustrates the effectiveness of that approach that we've taken over the years. And this is every 5 years the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service surveys hunting and fishing across the U.S. and takes a look at the changes in the participants and the economic impacts of that type of thing. And so I thought it would be, if you don't mind, we'll talk about that. For example, what we've seen in Texas from 2001 to 2006, we've seen a net gain of 286,000 saltwater anglers, an increase in saltwater anglers of some 25%. Now, it's not a particularly appropriate way to look at it, but it's a fun way to look at it. That means, or just a scary way to look at it, that, in fact, every month we've added 4,777 saltwater anglers for the last 60 months to Texas. And it's just not numbers. The numbers, not only are the new anglers fishing a lot, our old anglers are fishing more. We've seen an increase in 50% in fishing pressure. Well, what does this translate as? Well, I've taken a look at all the other states, and I would tell you that Texas is alone in its class. The other two large recreational fishing states have seen declines of 18%. Every other state in the Gulf, and you can see the drop there. In fact, of all 23 coastal fishing states in this country, only five other states have shown a positive increase in saltwater anglers. One of those was barely a half a percent. The other four, were states that have anglers in the 100,000 number. So it's basically insignificant. There is no one who has touched what we've been able to do in this very difficult time. Okay, that's numbers, but what does that translate? In other words, what are the contributions of that management philosophy that we have pursued over these years to Texas? Well, basically, what we've seen is a $319 million increase in retail sales, a 32% increase. That basically has translated into four-tenths, almost a half $1 billion in economic impact to this state. We've seen taxes paid increase by 62%, almost $63 million. and also an increase of 5,221 jobs. That's basically every year for the last 5 years, an increase of 1,000 new jobs related to recreational fishing. This is a big impact. This is why we watch this so closely, why we take recommend the actions that we have, and you have taken those actions. It's put us in this situation where no one else is. And we've appreciated that support, and that's really the basis of how we have gone forward in trying to make sure this happens. So with that, I think Robin, you have one more. Oh, we got one more slide. I'm sorry, I kind of got on my soapbox there, but.
Go ahead and finish it.
If you don't mind, if Robin, go ahead and finish it.
I'll just wrap up real quickly. With that, you know, I just want to make it official that we're proposing that our staff proposes that we adopt the current proposal with the amendments. We lost a title as we were merging things within our proclamation, and it was a per same title, and we want to get that back into place that this is only applying to the per same fishery as was the original intent. We're including or recommending that we include a rollover provision. Again, any underage or overage up to 10% total allowable catch can be carried over to the next year. And then the provisions for tracking will be established, and we will basically put in there that it's the CDFR or other reporting mechanisms specified by the department. In case for some reason this Captain Daily Fishing Reports goes away or we can't get it from National Marine Fisheries Service, we do want flexibility to ask them to fill out another type of log that would allow us to keep track of this quota.
With that, Mr. Chairman, appreciate the time. Any questions, sir?
Thank you. Mr. McCarthy.
First of all, Dr. McKinney, I want to tell you that I personally compliment you on your approach to this issue that has many facets to it. You have made a marvelous presentation here, and seeing your approach to science, seeing your approach to the collection of data, seeing your approach to the economic benefits to the state of Texas in approaching this resolution makes chills run up down my back. I really do compliment you and Robin, and the entire Saltwater Division has done a marvelous job.
Thanks,
sir. It's a tough issue, but you've done a great job.
Appreciate that.
Okay. As I understand it, this proposal would apply only to a company that engages in purse-seining?
There's two companies that pursue this, but really one in Texas waters, correct?
Well, I'm going to come back to that. Are there any other catch methods besides purse-seining?
There's a very small amount. We look for menhaden specifically in our trip ticket program. We couldn't find any catches of menhaden, but we do have a lump catch that would include menhaden and some other bait fish, and there were 18,000 pounds of that caught last year.
So an insignificant.
Very insignificant, catch. Yes.
This would protect the bait dealers along the entire coast of Texas.
And you say you have only two users? One
in Texas waters, really. There are two participants in this industry based out of Louisiana, and I don't know the size of them, but in Texas, the only company that purchases our permits for the boats is the one.
So this would be a proposed cap on the number of fish. What happens if there are additional users enter the market? What do you foresee in that case?
If we had a total allowable catch, they would all have to share that type of thing. It would be.
But how would the sharing work? Mm-hmm.
Well, under the current provision, it would work the same way. Basically, we would have an accounting mechanism when the total allowable catch is reached. We would basically close the season down. If there were a limited entry or some sort of other quota-based system that were put into place, then those shares could be divided up amongst those vessels or in this case, the company's vessels. So it may not make a lot of sense to have that kind of thing in the current situation. But certainly new entrants could enter the fishery right now. We don't really anticipate, given the capital nature of this fishery. But you know, there are other participants here in the Gulf as well.
or any other participant. And if you have this rollover provision, would that, you envision that being a private property right, or would that just be applied to whoever first come, first served?
The rollover is only what isn't caught, and maybe I'm not understanding your question exactly, but the rollover is
let me see if I can clarify. If you only have one participant in 2009 and they catch 1 million pounds under the total allowable catch, in the next season, if there's still just that one user, you're saying they can fish an additional million pounds. But suppose in that next season there are now three entrants, how do you propose that 1 million pounds be allocated, or is it grandfathered to the users that didn't take it in the years before?
Now, the way we would envision that is because there isn't any sort of individual privilege or right to that quota established right now, or there is no limited entry program. It would just go to add to the total allowable catch for the next year, and it would basically be first come, first serve. Mm-hmm. The additional million pounds would go to whoever caught it if there were new entrants in that next year.
What it would do is set up basically a derby fishing, which would be first come, first serve. That was an interest in limited entry, I think, was one of the concerns. That would be a way to address that issue. But under our existing rules and statutes, which would take legislation to establish limited entry, it would be whoever got it.
So total allowable catch for the next year would just be increased by that amount?
Yes.
That's correct.
Or if it went over, decreased.
Right. Sure.
By that amount.
Decreased, right.
It's just, again, it's just plus or minus whatever that number would be.
I don't mean to be dense, but what is the point of the rollover provision?
Well, one of the points was exactly how would we enforce it, and how, I mean, given the capacity of some of these vessels, if they're out fishing and we notify them on Tuesday, because we got their records on Friday that you know, we're at that point, you know, how would they handle that violation at that point? They've already got in the hull.
Right. We don't want to criminalize anyone pursuing trying to do business, and this is just a way of making that work.
Okay. Any other questions? Discussion? Okay. So I suggest we authorize staff to amend the proclamation to apply only first in fishery, include a rollover provision, and to provide for provisions for tracking. Any other comments on that or questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. And committee item number 8, Hunter Education Regulation, Steve Hall.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. My name is Steve Hall, Education Director. I oversee the mandatory hunter education program, and I'm here today to present an action item for your consideration tomorrow. In accordance with the hunter education statute, the commission may establish a minimum age for participation in the hunter education program. That current minimum age is 12 years of age, and that was set in 1988 by the commission. Hunter ed staff recommends lowering the minimum age to 9 years of age to better align ourselves with the policies of the Texas Youth Hunting Program out of our wildlife partnership with the Texas Wildlife Association, and also with a few of the other laws in other states, particularly New Mexico and Colorado, where we send a significant amount of our Texas hunters to those states. And those states do require proof of hunter education of those under 12 years of age. Hunter education instructors already accept students under 12 years of age in their courses, and we currently have about over 500 students that complete the course each year that are under 12 years of age. Public comment on the issue was 85% in favor, or 304, and 15% not in favor, and that was about 54 individuals. The recommendation that we'll be bringing forth tomorrow is in front of you, and I could accept any questions at this time.
Questions? Discussion? Thank you, Steve. Ralph?
Did any of the commenters who were negative base it on my personal situation, which when my sons were 9, they couldn't begin to comprehend this?
Yeah, there's two main reasons for opposal. One was this ascension of understanding and comprehension. The other is I don't want these kids out there hunting under the age of 12. And some of that was, you know, they don't want them hunting, and you know, they don't want them hunting. Period. Or the sense of, geez, now you're going to let these kids hunt by themselves. The fact of the matter is, most hunters under the age of 12 will be supervised, whether they have hunter education or not. Hunter ed is only a tool for safe and responsible hunting. To address your question, though, the in terms of it gets to that in terms of the safety of the individual. They would be supervised, even though technically they could hunt alone at that point. You know, if I was a 10-year-old, and in terms of the comprehension level, they simply fail the test and they'd have to take that test or that course over again. And that's the situation that we deal with now. We probably have, you know, not very many, but hundreds of folks that fail the test, so they simply have to go back through the process. We'll have more of those occasions with under 12-year-olds because of that comprehension level. There's also a skill and aptitude situation there as well. But again, as a tool for the parent, that's still the parental responsibility to try to upgrade their knowledge and their skills and their aptitude to be able to responsibly take either a deer in this case or an animal.
Thank you.
Great. Any other questions? Thanks, Steve. All right. I'll place this item on Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. And we're done. Okay, Advisory Committee rule amendments. Yeah. Right.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel. Very quickly, I will present the proposed rule amendments regarding advisory committees. As some very brief background, excuse me, the Parks and Wildlife Code authorizes the Commission Chairman to appoint advisory committees, and then the Government Code has some specific requirements for advisory committees. For example, we have to have a rule for each advisory committee. There has to be an annual evaluation. The presiding officer is selected by the member of the advisory committee. There's a limit of 24 members, and there's a 4-year life unless the committee is extended by rule. In 2005, the commission adopted rules regarding a number of advisory committees, including the Game Bird Advisory Committee, the Texas Quail Council, and the Operation Game Thief Committee. The proposal recommends the repeal of the advisory committee regarding OGT, the Operation Game Thief Committee. This committee is a statutorily created committee. They have their own authority. It doesn't really meet the government code definition of an advisory committee. Also, there's some other more specific rules regarding the operation of Operation Game Thief. The proposal also recommends that the Game Bird Advisory Board be replaced with the Migratory Game Bird Advisory Committee, and that the Texas Quail Council be replaced with the Upland Game Bird Advisory Committee. And this is the recommended motion that you will see tomorrow. We only received 17 comments over the internet, 14 agreed, 3 disagreed, and the only substantive comment we got just said that advisory committee members should not be reimbursed for their expenses. Under another section of these rules, one that is not being proposed for amendment, it clearly states that advisory committee members are not reimbursed for their out-of-pocket expenses. This is purely a voluntary endeavor. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ann. Any questions? Thanks. Okay, I'll place this item on Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. I'm getting used to saying that.
Yeah, there'll be plenty of it tomorrow.
And this committee has completed its business.
My favorite part.
Yeah.
Okay. Make sure we got. Sorry.
I got to do some.
I was right at the end. This is the journal. Okay. That was easy enough. This commission is completed.
We are adjourned.